Welcome everyone present, especially the members of the Portfolio Committee of Labour, whose full force today in their numbers, all parties are represented. I hope that you've recouped during the past 2 weeks. You allowed yourself to be re-energized. Some of us had the opportunity to be re-energized in hospital and on sick beds, but we are back full force in trying to close this matter before us. You notice, honorable members, also all the members from different organizations, the department, DG is here with his entourage, and everyone present, including the press. We want to welcome you to this Portfolio Committee of Labour. And we want to re-emphasize, honorable members, that we know that we've passed the stage of the oral presentations, but during the recess period, or just before the recess period, we've received a request for another round of oral submissions, and we've received written submissions. We know that we had our deadlines. We closed the submissions, the written submissions, on the 16th of March, and we've received submissions after that, and we saw it fit that especially with regards to SAFTU, which is a trade union federation representing a lot of trade union members, and we know that they are not represented in NEDLAC and they were not part of the process, we saw it fit that it's very important to hear their side, to hear the voice of those workers in terms of moving forward and taking their inputs into consideration as we conclude this National Minimum Wage Bill, as well as the amendments to the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and the amendments to the Labour Relations Act. So please bear with us. We know that we were supposed to start with our deliberations as a committee today, but it was really important for us also to hear the side from the employers' organization, NIASA, whom we know that they are representing employers, but also the Business Unity of South Africa as well as AgriSA, who were not able to present to us during the other round. But please note that we made that exception based on the reasons that I've just mentioned, in the interest of public participation, and we really want to hear all sides of the story before we may, reach a conclusion in terms of this issue. So we just want to welcome everyone present, and we want to state it, honorable members, presenters, that we're going to give you the opportunity, as been relayed by the committee secretary, to give a presentation for 15 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes, and then we open for discussion by the committee members for another 20 minutes, and then we move forward. We're not going to have an open-ended discussions this time around. We are really pressed for time. Also, can we give over to the secretary just to give us an indication of the apologies that we currently have. We want to welcome also our new researcher. We know that the researcher of the committee resigned last year, and Mr. Tebogo Mokoena is our new researcher being appointed. You are welcome, sir, to this committee. You have to hit the ground running. We are on autopilot mode at the current moment. And with those few words, I want to officially open this meeting. We have noted, I've noted hands, Mr. Mashile, as well as Ms. Teko, you've raised hands.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I just wanted to indicate that the view that we have taken to reopen and have this presentation is supported. We, from the ANC, of course, is that we will support inclusivity to the maximum that we can have, so that we don't have a certain organizations that would feel being excluded. Of course, it's, as we move forward in future, we need to comply to the deadlines that are set, because they are set within the holistic programs of Parliament. And organizations, of course, need to be encouraged to comply to the deadlines, but your spirit of inclusivity in this particular manner is supported. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile, Honorable Teko.
Thanks, Chair. That was my point to say. We at the ANC were supporting the inclusivity, but the issue of deadline, the dates were set and it was publicized. So this issue of us today as a PC were supposed to be started with our deliberations. Now we will be a day behind because of this process. However, we respect the decision of you, Chair, of allowing them to come and present to us. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Moteka, and then Honorable Begram.
Chairperson, thanks very much, but I think you have started on a wrong note. You can remember that as the EFF, we have asked for these extensions from the beginning, that you cannot conclude this matter without involving other partners in the labor, more especially the federations like SAFTU and all that. And we even wrote you a letter, and you rejected our request in writing. So I think the better way of starting this was to apologize to those who you have rejected their view, and then, because the decision of extending, you did it alone during the recess, whereas we did the request and all that. We are not opposing the move. We are supporting it, and we just want to put it on record that we told you a long time ago, you never had it. Yes, thank you.
Honorable Begram.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to comment. Like my colleague in the EFF, I agree that we have started on the wrong note. You will recall, Chairperson, that at the time when we were deciding whether there were going to be any extensions to the discussions, I specifically pointed out that SAFTU had not been invited to come and speak to us, and being probably the second largest labor organization in the country, maybe soon to be the largest, I'm very pleased that they are here to give us their input. And I specifically asked us, and in fact, it was the ANC that decided that they didn't want to send a special invite to SAFTU, and I'm not sure why, and maybe you can explain that at some later date. Maybe now is not the time. And I was upset. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we now have got them here. We should have actually then advised the public that we had opened the discussions again. And there might be others. There might be other trade unions. We've had a dearth of trade unions coming forward to address us. And there might be others that wanted to come, and I think it's unfair to them as to why they can't actually have an opportunity like we've given rightly to SAFTU to address us. And they are a loud voice. They are a voice that must be heard. And in fact, they've been, I think, unfairly discriminated against with regard to NEDLAC. And I think they should be a very strong voice within NEDLAC. Other than to say, of course, NEDLAC, no one listened to them anyway. But that's just my comment. The other thing I did want to say, and I hear from my two ANC colleagues, that we've got deadlines, and I hear that from you as well. I'm not sure what deadlines they are, and who set these deadlines, and why are there deadlines? What is going on? Maybe I've been completely remiss in not reading some piece of legislation or some deadline that we had. I know the only deadline that was somehow announced in Parliament, the State of the Nation address, is that this would be implemented on the 1st of May. Well, we've missed that deadline. And thankfully, sir, I think that was reckless. But I'm not sure what deadlines we're talking about now. We've got time. We've got a whole parliamentary session coming forward. And we can meet every Wednesday for that. Thank you for listening to me.
Honourable America.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning to all. Madam Chair, in terms of process, I'd like to know is that yesterday we received departmental responses with regard to submissions by interested parties. Now, I've gone through those submissions, that responses, and curious enough, there was responses to the submissions that we're going to hear today. So my question is this just a compliance process? To what extent, you know, I mean, we have not listened to the submissions yet, but yet the department has responded to submissions forwarded by the parties that's going to deliver today. I'd like to know that.
Thank you, honourable members, for those inputs. Honourable Madisha.
No, thank you, Chair. I think we should begin and really go on with the meeting. I want to emphasize that we thank you, we thank all the members. When one proposed that we should invite, you know, the biggest federation, for example, today, I mean, in line with the scientific analysis that is there, well, we'll talk about that elsewhere. I think I'm quite happy that that has been done. I'm talking about SAFTU here. And we'll go into that later. We'll talk about, you know, other structures, etc., later. But then I think we now have got to begin and really go on with the meeting. We have, some of us, gone through the documents that were sent, and one is quite happy, and I'm quite happy that all members here are agreed that we must go on, and one is quite happy that all the organizations now have been invited, and we can go on. No seclusion. SAFTU is here, other organizations are here, let's go on, make sure that they make an input. Thank you very much. Let's begin.
Thank you, Honourable Madisha, for that one. So we're going to close this matter. But just in response on what has been raised, Honourable Members, we would, when talking about deadlines and talking about the request made by the EFF, Honourable Mateka, you've requested us to reopen the process of submissions for and extend it to a further 2 weeks would give us towards the end of March. And that is the request that I have declined. Based on the fact that as all parties that's been represented in this committee, we've agreed on the process that we need to follow. And the view has been expressed, and we've agreed on the deadlines, Honourable Begram, being that we'll have the 3 weeks of opening the the process of submissions by advertising, which led us to almost 4 weeks at the end. And hence I told you that we are not seeing that it was a decision of this committee, which all of us supported, that we can't reopen that process. What happened is we didn't engage different organizations personally and requested them to make inputs, because the adverts were clear and it was broadcasted, it was advertised broadly across the country. For everyone who's interested, they would have noticed the adverts and they could have responded to it. The only reason why I opened the doors, the windows slightly, is because of the fact that I've already mentioned that SAFTU is a recognized trade union federation and it's having a lot of members. And we really want to hear their voice. It's not a matter that we wanted to shut them out. They didn't take, they didn't make use of the opportunity. Also, all the other people who are outside, we've included them by the adverts. We didn't say that the adverts is supposed to be for certain individuals, but it was open. Anyone who was interested was supposed to take part to that process. So that's the main reason. It's not a matter that we wanted to sideline anyone or close the door to anyone. And that's exactly why we are sitting here today. So without moving forward, without delaying the process any further, we're going to start with the first presentation by Nyasa. Over to you, Mr. Papenfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was last on the list, now I'm first on the list. But that's a biblical thing, when those who are last will be first. Madam Chair, our submissions was introduced or sent to the Department of Labour already on the 12th of December, just for the record. We weren't late, but thank you for this opportunity this morning. We are only going to focus on one clause, section 32, for the purposes of this presentation. I just want to say that we are fundamentally opposed to extension of agreements, but this is not what we're going to talk to you about. We're going to deal with what the Act says. And the first thing that we're going to deal with is the provision in the Constitution. The Constitution on collective bargaining, where it says that every trade union, employers organization, employer has the right to engage in collective bargaining. That's a fundamental constitutional right. And the Act, the Labor Relations Act, the purpose of the Act is to give effect and regulate the fundamental rights conferred by the Constitution, to provide a framework within collective bargaining takes place, and to promote orderly collective bargaining. And this is on this, it's by our submission is based on this provision in both the Constitution and the Act, in the sense that we feel that the amendments deny both employers and employees this fundamental right. Let's start off with Section 32, which currently says that if the minister receives a request to extend an agreement, she must within 60 days extend that agreement. That's the current Section 32. There's a new section that's brought in, Section 32A, which extend that function by the minister by including organizations that's no longer a majority, but which now is only sufficiently representative. But it is made subject in 32 to the new A to subsection 32.5A. And we just want to point out, and maybe it's only an oversight, because we don't think this is such is a bad inclusion, but it only makes it subject to section 32.5 5A instead of currently 32.5A to D. That's very important sections, subsections in B to D, which the minister, in our view, need to comply with. For instance, the minister must be satisfied that failure to extend the agreement may undermine collective bargaining. She must publish a notice in the Government Gazette inviting comments, and the minister has to consider those comments, which in the proposed amendment is left out. And as I say, maybe it's just an oversight, but we think it's important that those three sections be retained.
Mr. Papenfuss,
yes.
Can you just pause there?
Yes.
Honourable members, we are sorry that I know it's very difficult for you to follow now, but we haven't received this presentation from Mr. Papenfuss for the members to follow it. Can you just try and send us a soft copy in the meantime? Because it's different, difficult for us to. Yeah. It's just for members' own interest, just to have it. But you can proceed. In the meantime, before we move forward, I see we have little members in our gallery today. We want to welcome you to Parliament of South Africa. And we are the Portfolio Committee of Labour. And we are here to discuss important bills that we know that will affect you in the future. So we hope that you'll enjoy this visit to Parliament. This is your Parliament, and it's good that you take part in this process by your visit. Honourable members, just before we move forward also, we've received apologies from Honourable Martens, the Honourable Tluama, as well as the Honourable Kurai, who's not able to attend today. We can move forward, Honourable Mr. Papenfuss.
Madam, can we send a hard copy of the soft copy then to you afterwards, to the Secretary? Good, thank you. Section 32.3, these amendments we think is quite profound. Currently, Section 32.3 says that the Minister must extend a collective agreement where the parties, both on the employer side and on the trade union side, represents a majority. On the in trade union side, the majority of the employees, and employer side, the majority of employees in the employ of employers. And what is done in this proposed amendment? This is the current provisions in the Act as it stands in the Act. But and this is just a repeat, majority on both sides. But what is proposed that in between between Section 32.3 B and C, the legislator proposes here to put in the word or. So what it says is that the parties only need to be representative on one side, either employers or the employees. So what is the effect of this, Madam Chair, is that firstly, the employer party might even represent a small percentage of employers. If that party, the small percentage of employers, represent the majority of employees, they can ask the minister to extend, even if the employees on the other side represents a minority. What we have in one of the biggest bargaining councils is where the employers currently, and I think that this is done to accommodate them, where the employers have is as little as 12% representative in the in the steel industry, for instance. They can conclude an agreement with a body on the other side comprising of 1% of the employees, because only one side need to be representative. And the minister, in terms of this provision, if that amendment is put into effect, the minister will be obliged to extend that agreement to 99% of employees in the industry. as well as to non-parties who had no say in the conclusion of the agreement. So it excludes parties. So you don't have to organize anymore. Only one party need to organize. Trade unions don't have to organize. They will ride on the strength of the employees employed by big employers. And of course this will apply where a similar arrangement will apply where there's a big trade union on the one side and very small employers very weakly organized on the other side. This amendment, in our view, Madam Chair, will interfere with the principles of majoritarianism, voluntarism, and the constitutional right not to associate with a trade union or employers' organization. So this can actually force upon industries which are weakly organized. It will negate the need for trade unions to recruit members as extension is practically guaranteed. It will lead to increased dissatisfaction among SMEs as big business will now be able to enforce their unaffordable arrangements upon them with ease. And then we make this point, Madam Chair, that the argument that collective bargaining is about coverage and not representativity cannot pass constitutional muster as it is aimed at protecting big business with more employees, tantamount to stating that because the union is poorly represented, large employers now negotiate with themselves on behalf of their employees. Madam Chair, it's often said that collective bargaining is aimed at level the playing field and avoid competition between big employers on the back of employee wages. However, what is seemingly permissible is unfair competition by large employers on the back of the financial and operational limitations of SMEs. I just want to mention 4 points which is not on my notes, which is not on the screen. The cost of labor as a percentage of turnover for a big business might be as low as 5% and even lower. For a small business, it might be as high as 50 to 60%. So a wage increase for a small big business can be as low as 1%. Doesn't matter. Secondly, the cost of doing business in the economic hubs of South Africa, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, is completely different to what it is doing business in small towns somewhere in South Africa. Completely different rules, logistical arrangements. SMEs do not enjoy the benefits of economies of scale. They cannot negotiate better prices. And lastly, big business are price givers. They pass on the price of material and wages to small business. So a big business can pass on an increase to employees, and by the increase in the price of material, it doesn't cost them a cent, but the small guy pays twice. He pays for more expensive material, and he pays the higher wage. We think this is fundamentally wrong, madam. Section 32.6, that's the next page, deals with where an agreement is, the period of operation of an agreement is extended, Section 32.6. Where the agreement is unchanged, but the parties decide that the life of this agreement is extended. And currently in the Act, it is made subject to the provisions of Section 32.6b, which refers to subsections 3 and 5. Now, I just want to say what is in 3 and 5. It says currently, the subsection of B that is now left out. What it says is that the majority of employers and employees must ask for the extension. It makes provision that upon extension, the trade unions represent the majority of employees in the industry and in business employ the majority of employees. It makes provision for executive exemption procedure. It makes provision for appeals body and exemptions criteria. And certain things that the minister must take into consideration when you extend. But section 32.6b is now left out. So what does it mean? It means that the minister can extend an agreement without having regard to any of these issues. Representativity plays no longer a role. It is simply for the minister to decide on a good day that she wants to do it. Non-parties have no right to be heard. It is not in line with the rules of administrative justice. And it will allow for bargaining councils, which have very low levels of representativity, to be kept alive, artificially kept alive. It is completely unconstitutional in our view, Madam Chair. It is no longer extension of agreements or agreements by means of negotiations. There's no longer negotiations. It is labor relations on sectorial level by decree. It is what the minister decides she wants to do. When it comes to the next point, when it comes to fund agreements, I've read that. When it comes to fine fund agreements, there's currently no provision in the Labor Relations Act with regard to the extension of funds agreement, because funds agreements is regarded currently as a normal collective agreement, and it's extended on the basis as other agreements are extended. Now, the proposed section 32A, I just want to see if it's 32A is brought in, and the effect of this proposed inclusion is that the minister can extend a fund agreement to an industry based on a request by a single party. So it can be an employer body or a union representing 1% to the party. Now, it is so because of the current stuff that's going on in bargaining councils. There are certain employers which no longer want to contribute to the funds of those councils, and they were withholding the funds, those funds, in one council in particular now, currently. And they do that because of what is going on in that council, and this amendment is introduced, we believe, to circumvent that, to say the minister can simply force that upon councils, and we think that is unconstitutional. So what we say is that it will allow the minister to extend fund agreements which is about to expire for a period of 12 months at the request of any of the parties to the council. There's only one criteria, and that criteria is whether the minister thinks it's in the interest of collective bargaining. Representativity plays no role. And we say that the conclusion of collective bargaining agreements, including the time period of an agreement, falls within the domain of collective bargaining. It is not for the minister to interfere in how the parties choose to run their affairs in respect of funding of a council or benefits provided by the parties. Lastly, it infringes on the principles of majoritarianism and self-determination. Then, in general, madam, these agreements, provisions, proposed provisions, in our view, is unconstitutional, and this is why we say so. The Bill of Rights afford every employer and employee the right to engage in collective bargaining. What is done in terms of these provisions is that trade unions and employers are excluded. It is now the extension of agreements which plays a huge role in the economy can henceforth be done by the minister by decree. Doesn't matter who says what and how, what is the levels of representativity, the minister can decide it will be extended. That's the right to engage in collective bargaining, of course, and that's the second point, includes the right not to engage in collective bargaining. You cannot, because certain parties do not want, is not happy with certain arrangements, decide that since the parties can't come to the agreement, the minister will now enforce certain arrangements on the parties. Collective bargaining is aimed at organized sectors. That's the third point there. In other words, if you're not organized, well, then you're not in the area, you can't play in the area of collective bargaining. Then you must have a separate arrangement with the minister through sectoral determinations, make wages for the industry. But then that's no longer collective bargaining. Legislation, fourth point on the board, legislation aimed at allowing selected parties operating in unorganized minority sectors to enforce their agreements on the majority who selected not to participate in collective bargaining undermines and limits the constitutional right of parties. At the top, enabling minority parties to extend the collective agreements to majorities is selective bargaining, not collective bargaining. Second point on that page, legislating collective bargaining to this extent no longer creates a framework for collective bargaining as it is envisaged by the LRA, but infringes on the rights of parties and non-parties to self-determination. Such limitations cannot be said to be reasonable and justifiable in a democratic society based on equality. Madam, why are they doing this? I think because of what's happened in a particular, the biggest bargaining council in South Africa, which no longer can extend agreements because of the strength of SMMEs, I think what they want to do is to say, well, if the parties can't agree on anything, well, then we give the power to the minister. And I just want to take you through these pages, madam, and I'm not going to deal with the pages. Look at the court cases we had. 2010, there was an arbitration which showed that the council was completely unconstitutional and, in fact, extended agreements without being even in existence. It was unlawfully done and enforced, and employees were forced out of business on the basis of an illegal agreement. 2011, NYASA brought an urgent application in the labor court. Parties misled the court, and we lost that court case on the basis of urgencies. And that was the last time we lost. 2011, court case brought by NYASA, and when the outcome of that case came in 2012, the judge referred to this whole dispensation as a sham. It's a fraud. But they continued. 2014, we brought another application to set aside the extension of agreement. This time the judge said, don't they learn? They repeated that. 2014-17 agreement NYASA entered into, and it was confirmed by court, an agreement with
him. You have 1 minute remaining.
Sorry, madam?
You have 1 minute remaining.
Thank you very much. The minister, we ended in agreement with NUMSA. The minister simply ignored that and extended another agreement to the industry. 2015-16, you can read it for yourself. I just want to just refer to what the experts say, what the previous governor of the Reserve Bank, John Marcus, said. What does the IMF says about this extension of agreements arrangements? It's detriment to the economy. The current Reserve Bank governor agrees. The president recently said in SONA that we need to create a business-friendly agreement, collective business-friendly environment, and these bargaining councils are not a business-friendly environment. Last page, madam, that's a conclusion. So just a large page. These amendments will not strengthen collective bargaining, but will elicit an even stronger pushback. Powers given to the minister are autocratic of nature and takes place outside of the context of collective bargaining. This doesn't involve collective bargaining. Negotiations and consensus-seeking processes. Some of the amendments are infringes on constitutional rights and will be challenged. A new inclusive approach is required for collective bargaining to survive. Underlying fundamental principles of collective bargaining are voluntarism, majoritarianism, and consensus. Legislation aimed at forcing employers and employees into collective bargaining arrangements of minorities will completely undermine these principles and may very well lead to the demise of the system. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Papenfuss. Honourable members, we're going to open for deliberations. We'll take the first round of discussions, then give over to Mr. Papenfuss to respond. We'll allow each member 3 minutes to engage, because we really need to be objective and give everyone a fair chance. I'm noting hands. Honourable Begram, Honourable Muteka, Honourable Mashile, Honourable America, in that order, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure why 3 minutes, but I'll try and do justice to the first few questions I have. In essence, what this looks like, Mr. Papenfuss, is that the minister is going to run mostly labor relations by regulation and not legislation. That's the horrific thread running through these amendments. I can point them all out to you, but I don't have the time. But there's a horrific thread even with the exemptions. The minister makes the decision, and we're not even allowed to discuss how the regulations are going to work. And that's what you're telling us. The other thing, and maybe you can comment on that, the other thing that you're saying is that small business can be very easily pushed out of business because all you need is for big union, big business, to put up a wage much higher than is necessary or than can be sustainable, and then small businesses have to die. And maybe you can comment on that. I could extend that discussion. I don't have the time. It also looks like, to a large degree, that small black business, mostly in the townships, will have to, by any reasoning, will have to just avoid legislation altogether. Will have to just govern themselves and not try and adhere to any legislation. We don't have the capacity in any event to monitor or regulate them. So it's going to force them out of the picture completely. And maybe you can also comment on the idea of the minister must extend. We then, in fact, by legislation, are saying that the minister now has to listen to big business. Shouldn't they actually put the word should, or no, maybe not even should, but may extend? At least give some power to the minister on that basis, because here you've got bargaining councils who can just force the minister to do things. And again, we're not running any labor legislation by legislation. We're running it again by regulation and by bargaining councils. Yes, I hear you about the constitutional challenge. This is real good stuff for lawyers. It's very nice for them. It'll keep them in employ and actually push their minimum wages up very high. But thank you for that. I'm very upset that I've only given 3 minutes, but we'll hear about that later.
Honourable Muteka, but please take note, honourable members, that we're giving the opportunity for clarity-seeking questions, not to make our own inputs. We know that we have will have the opportunity as the committee to deliberate on the questions, so on the presentations. So in the absence of any clarity-seeking questions, we don't need to have long preambles and stuff like that. If we are clear, then it's fine. Honorable Muteka.
Thank you, Chairperson. My take on this presentation is like, you know, currently, Mr. As we talk, things are very bad, and more worse for the workers. Workers are getting exploited. They are getting below the poverty level rates, which we cannot say things should go as usual. So hence we are calling for the meaningful and proper national minimum wage. So, what is your suggestion? I don't think you are suggesting that we must allow the small business to do as they wish, as it is currently more or less happening. I don't think you are asking for that. So I want to know from you, what is your proposal to solve this problem? Because currently, we are saying the workers are not getting any living wage. It means they are working for nothing. So what is your proposal to solve this problem? Because I don't think you are saying they are right as things are happening. They must be like that. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honorable Muteka, Honorable Mashile.
Thanks, Chairperson. I have listened carefully on the input that has been made. And as much as there is a genuine concern, but I've got a feel that it is taken to extremes. And also, maybe I can have the clarity whether NIASA thinks that the minister can be seriously arbitrary, unilateral, in taking decisions and just ignore the participants in the sector, in the minister's duty to protect workers, and also whether NIASA understands that as much as the workers are protected or they are given protection by the unions that they belong in, but at the end of the day, government is responsible of what is happening up there. And when workers are not happy or not satisfied, they always run to government officials and government ministers and complain. And the government of the day has got a duty, of course, to intervene where the workers are not actually getting a good deal. And therefore, there is a need for the minister to intervene when the relevant participants are not actually coming to the table to resolve issues that they are supposed to resolve. And also to check with NIASA, what is your view when a particular employer is not prohibited from participating in a particular bargaining council, and this employer decides not to participate, and decisions that relate to the workers that belong to that particular employer are taken, and when those decisions are now implemented across, then you cry foul when you have not been prohibited to actually participate. What is your view there? And then the right that you have actually mentioned in the Constitution, our understanding, or my understanding, not necessarily representing others, is that rights can always be limited by means of legislation. You don't have unfettered rights that they call absolute rights. Rights can always be limited by means of legislation when there is a need for that to happen, then there is a good cause for that to happen. And what is your understanding when there is an extension on an agreement and the minister has to actually publicize a notice in a government gazette? What's the intention of such a notice being publicized in the government gazette? And what is your understanding on the provisions of recourse to the labor court when you are not satisfied? Are there not actually safeguards that no decision will be taken in the dark corners? Something has to be publicized in the government gazette so that everybody is aware of the intention of the minister, so that anybody that has got a problem then has got recourse to actually intervene or interact. And if you are not happy again, the access to the labor court, are those not safeguards that actually will prohibit any unilateral decision making that is not necessarily informed by the participants in the sector? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. Honorable America.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to add to what the previous speaker stated. The representative NIASA states that the deletion of Section 32.6B will allow parties with low representativity to prevent agreements from being implemented, hence their objection to it. So, if I put it to you, Mr. Papenfuss, is that it's precisely because of that possibility that the minister would be empowered to extend agreements to allow benefit funds and councils to operate and be continue to exist, where you are of the view that one, it is unconstitutional, and that parties who are not party to that particular council will be negatively impacted. But there's a proviso also in the Act, is that non-parties could apply for exemptions. And as the previous speaker has stated, you have also legal recourse if you are of the view that the extension of those agreements will impact negatively upon you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable America. Mr. Papenfuss, can you respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I now understand why I'm not a parliamentarian. You know, you've got to keep up with these things. Now, I can't read my first notes. I'll try my best. Mr. Bagram, you're right. This, by leaving out certain fundamental provisions in the Act, the minister can now make laws, because these agreements are laws, without a party negotiating those laws. Big business, you know, some people call this whole arrangement in bargaining councils are cartels, price-fixing cartels. And it is true, they are price-fixing cartels. And that's why they are specifically excluded from the Competitions Act. Because if they were included in the Competitions Act, they would have been in big trouble. But now they're excluded. Big business sit around the tables. And as I say, in one industry, 12% of business make laws for 88% of small businesses. Now, if you have, and I'm using this as an example, a business all over South Africa, one business employing 1,000 people all over South Africa, and that business enter into an arrangement with the employees, they can go to the department and say, we want to extend this agreement to 1,000 little businesses, each employing one employee, and the minister must do that. Now, he can, in effect, destroy his competition. This is what's happening. This is why industries are losing. In the last 12 years, the metal industry bargaining council lost 100,000 jobs in 10 years. Did I say 12 years? 10 years. 100,000 jobs. We're not increasing. Employment figures are daily dropping. Now, just to come back to another question, you know, people, times are tough outside there. There's nothing worse not having a job. And the industry do not employ anymore. They just don't employ. I can keep you busy for days telling you about businesses that had 200 people now have a, they import products. You can't manufacture anymore, competitive in manufacture anymore. And you're right, Mr. Bagram, that small business goes underground. They simply don't register. They go underground. They fly under the radar, because if they don't, if a bargaining council official walk into your business, that can more or less be the end of your business. If you are forced to pay these wages, which is very uncompetitive, and remember, we're not talking about what is a good wage or a bad wage. If a wage is uncompetitive, you can't pay it. It is indeed so that Section 32 said the minister must extend, but you know, there was a court case where the court said that all these decisions by the minister is subject to administrative justice. But What has happened now, though, is to take that out of the equation of administrative justice. Because we can no longer challenge the minister. She makes a decision, and we think that is unconstitutional. Let me come back to Honorable Moteka, which said that times are very bad. What do we suggest? Sir, you know, it sounds insensitive, and it's not meant to be. But if you force a wage upon an employer, which he doesn't want to pay, and B, he can't pay, you're not going to pay it. Now, this is not debate how bad employers is. This is a fact of life. If somebody knocks on your door and demands a wage, he demands a wage, and you say, I'm not going to pay that wage, then you don't employ him. And nobody on earth can force an employer to do that. He says, I'm not going to employ you. Now, this is not a debate about bad, hard-hearted employers. This is a fact of life. If I don't want to pay a wage, then I'm not going to pay it. So if we make wages on a level that employers can't afford or don't want to pay, for whatever reason, it will lead to unemployment, and we see that is happening. So we must be careful that when we do this, we don't make the circumstances of employees even worse. And I mean, we have a problem of an employment rate of unofficially between 30% and 40%. I mean, this has got to be the first objective, to get people to work, because there are generations where mothers and fathers and children don't work, they don't learn any skills, because employers said we can't afford to pay. Because you must pay a wage, manufacture a product, and then sell that product at a price which is competitive. And the moment you go out of the competitive range, employers fire all the employees and import. I can show you store houses where in the past 200-300 employees worked, where now 12 people are working. They are importing stuff, and they're becoming retailers. The Honorable Mashika, is that Mashika, sir? Mashile, sorry, my mistake. Well, you say, do we think that the minister can unilaterally ignore the input of parties and extend? Well, what this legislation proposed changes do is that the minister don't have to get our input anymore. She can simply... The provisions that the minister must get input and consider it is now written out of the act if it is introduced. She doesn't have to listen to other parties. That's not part of the agreement. And we cannot no longer go to court, because we've done it in the past, where we went to court and say the minister hasn't complied with the law, and the court stopped her from extending. This is done so that we can no longer do that. If the minister decides, in her opinion, it's in the interest of collective bargaining, she simply extends. And it can happen where an employer body, employing a lot of big business, employing a lot of employees, enter into an agreement, in some cases, with a union representing 1% of employees. And then it's extended to the rest. And a guy that doesn't have a job is now excluded forever, his whole life, from entering the market. On the question of all businesses is required to participate in, you've got to register with bargaining councils. You don't have to, you participate in bargaining councils through employer bodies and unions and workers through their unions. But you cannot compel them to do so. But the business has to register with bargaining councils and then comply with the provisions of that bargaining council. This legislative changes indeed not only limit our constitutional rights, but it completely takes it away. If the minister says one party has come to an agreement with somebody else, which is a majority party, don't need to be any negotiations. And yes, it is true that constitutional rights can be limited, but, you know, you'll have to convince the Constitutional Court that this is really in a very extreme situation where you actually can do that. The purpose of the publication in the Government Gazette is to invite comments for the Minister to consider. And it also, and this is what happened with us, the moment it's published in the Government Gazette, we get all the documentation, we study it, and then we go to the minister and say, Minister, on the following grounds, you cannot extend. And if the minister said, notwithstanding what you say, we're going to extend, well, then we go to court. And we've done that successfully. If this is introduced, we will no longer be able to go to court. So it's very effective if you want to completely get us out of this thing completely.
Can you wrap up in 2 minutes, please?
Last question. Honorable America, I wonder what Donald Trump says from Mr. America. It's not parties with low representativity that's blocking agreements being extended. It is parties with almost zero representativity which will now be able to, with other parties on the other side, extend agreements. It's exactly the opposite. If you're a majority in this industry, both on union and business side, you can extend agreements, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. Our problem is when minorities extend their will to the majority in order to push them out of business. Thank you, Manager.
Thank you, Mr. Papenfuls. Do we have any follow-up question? Question, not input. Honorable Moteka, Honorable Mashile, just a quick...
Chairperson, I think the question of forwarded to the man there was not really answered. Because I'm saying to him...
Honorable Moteka, can you please refer to him as Mr. Papenfuls?
Mr. who? Mr. Papenfuls. Okay. And then my question is, it was, as things are standing, we see the employers living luxury life, but on daily basis, complaining about the insulting wages that they are giving to the employees who are not even affording the school kids fees. They can't build houses, they can't do everything. But these people are living a very, very high luxury life. But at the same time, they are crying like you are saying you are doing now. So that's why I was saying to you, are you saying we must just keep it like that? They deserve it. Because the reason for this intervention of national minimum wage is to solve that problem. Or you don't see it as a problem yourself. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honorable Moteka. Honorable Mashile.
Thanks, Chairperson. As much as we will agree on an issue that says people must get employment, but also, of course, is that I think we can agree that those employed then must be turned into slaves and work for nothing, for purposes of employers then to be happy to pay a salary. That is meager. I think this particular balance must be understood, because we all understand, of course, that employers ordinarily, they would like employees that works for them and then they pay them nothing. I think that is the best scenario that they will actually enjoy. But for some other reason is that there must be a balance that labor that is being given to the employers then must also be remunerated adequately and not to really have slaves working for them. And I think that must be understood, that surely we must find some sort of a meeting place where the workers also don't live slavery life, but while employed and assisting employers to actually make their profits. The other issue that I just wanted to raise, Chair, is is the NIASA to look at this particular bill, not to be totally complete on its own, that they can really make all sorts of decisions about it, with the exclusion of the regulations that are required to speak to some of those provisions that are in there. Because the regulations are actually going to explain the how part of things that are going to be done in terms of the bill. And whether they expected the bill to be self-explanatory and complete as a regime. And I just wanted to indicate that there is no way that the bill can be almost complete, that when you read it, then it gives a regime that is self-implementable without regulations. The regulations will be required to explain much of the same thing that is complaining about. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. Mr. Papen, who's to you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam, we're not called upon to discuss the issue on wages and low wages. We're commenting on this legislative changes, which has nothing to do on wages as such. It's about the constitutionality of these changes. But I just want to say this, that the perception that employers live high lives, you know, 90% of employees are employed by SMMEs. And if you go through towns of South Africa and you go to the SMMEs, you know, we're not talking about big business. Big business employ a small percentage of people in this country. And there are people with serious salaries and incomes and shares, etc. That is not the case with SMMEs. Their houses are bonded. I can tell you stories of business owners riding around with motorbikes because they have given up their cars. Now, people laugh about it when we say that. And it's these people, that is SMMEs, that is struggling. If an SME can't pay wages, they pay wages and they don't pay themselves. And you know that when you go to a small businessman and woman and you talk to them, and then you understand how they battle to keep their businesses alive. It's not the guys with the big BMWs and big Mercedes. They are not the SMMEs of this country. So that is wrong. There are people that's earning millions. It's not the SMMEs. And there are SMMEs, of course, that's doing well. And the notion that as entrepreneurs do not want to pay their people, it is simply not true. An entrepreneur loves to pay his people. You know, I strongly object to the notion that we want slaves and we don't want to pay them at all. You know, but it's said often by people that's never employed anyone in their lives. This is wrong. That is true. That is true because that's been said that employers, if they could pay them nothing, they won't pay them anything. You know, we don't know what is happening in business and how hard it is, but root out business and see what happens. No, we can't keep it like it is, sir. We've got an unemployment rate of between 30% and 40%, and the state is carrying that burden, and the tax ability is barely to decline, and one day these guys will not have jobs. And then all these councils fall flat, because in Africa there are no bargaining councils. Then,
Mr. Papenfuss, can you round
Mr.
up?
Mr. Mashile, no, we don't want to employ slaves, sir.
And then
regulations, if you don't have...
The point of order, can we hear the point of order, please? Honorable Moteka.
I feel offended when the Minierde is saying, I'm making this point because I never employed anyone in my life. So I think he must withdraw that thing before.
Honorable, thank you, Honorable Moteka. Mr. Papenfuss, we invite you to respond to the different bills. without we are allowed to ventilate, but we must refrain from attacking individuals in their personal capacity. So can we please ask you to withdraw that statement you made to the Honourable Member?
Madam Chair, I withdraw that. And I wish to add, I did not refer
to
him,
much.
But I withdraw that statement.
But it's him who made the comment. Thank you very much.
That's good. It's withdrawn.
Unconditional. Thank you. Mr. Bavi?
It's another very offensive racist statement.
Can we refrain from that, Mr. Vavi? You'll have your opportunity to present. Can we please refrain from that? We've requested Mr. Papenfuss to withdraw the statement which he made to the Honourable Member, and he did so unconditionally, I believe. Thank you very much. Thank you.
There's the second matter he said that is absolutely offensive. He says in Africa, there are no bargaining councils. That's a very loaded racist statement because it's not even factually correct. It is a typical prejudice statement, prejudicial statement that is intended to insult me as an African. And I take an exception to that.
Thank you. It's noted, Mr. Papenfuss. We know that's not a fact. Can you please withdraw that statement as well and refrain from making any derogatory statements? Thank you.
Chair, before I do that, it wasn't meant to be racist. When I talk to Africa, this is part of Africa. I'm an African. There are no bargaining councils in Africa.
But we know that that's not factual, Mr. Papenfuss. Can you refrain from
Madam
that?
Chair,
Can you withdraw that statement, please?
Okay, then I want to insist, Madam, I will withdraw that unconditionally. I will also want to insist withdrawal of the statement that employers want to employ slaves, and if they could, they will not pay them anything. I think that is unfair.
And can we move forward? Honourable Moteka, you've had your opportunity, you've raised your concern, it's been dealt with. Can we not go into a back and forth debate in terms of this issue? I'm not going to allow you to speak further. You've raised your concerns. Can we request Mr. Papenfuss to round up in 30
seconds,
please?
Can you allow me to deal with this insult? We cannot.
Pardon?
Can you allow me to deal with this insult?
No,
I've
requested Mr. Papenfuss to withdraw his derogatory statements and also the false statements that he's made. That's been alerted by Mr. Vavi, and he did it unconditionally, so can we leave this matter at that? Thank you.
Chairperson, it's attitudes like this that makes things worse down there in the factories. It's attitudes like this. If he can't respect the leadership of the workers, how is it?
Mr. Moteka, can you please refrain, please? The point has been taken. Mr. Papenfuss, can you just round up in 30 seconds without making any further derogatory statements? Thank you.
Madam Chair, on the issue of regulations, if the overriding provision in the Act is taken out of the Act, there can't be any regulations. You can't make regulations if the Act, the provision of the Act is absent. Madam Chair, nothing I said was meant to be racist. And to the extent that you've heard that, I just want to say that. But that's enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Papenfuss. We'll give over to the next presenter, which is Mr. Zwelinzima Vavi from SAFTU. We'll allow them to set up. In the meantime, honourable members, in the meantime, I just want you to take note that there has been several other processes, including the NEDLAC process, including the departmental process, and the parliament process is a different process. So that's why we're having this round of oral presentations. So if we say that you did submit it to the department, we requested also the different stakeholders to present their submissions to us directly. So we'll close it at that. Thank you very much to Mr. Papenfuss. In the meantime, to all the other presenters that still need to present, if they have another copy that's an amended version to that, the copy that they've presented, can you please forward to the committee secretary the soft copy so that members can also have that? Thank you.
Chairperson,
the presentation in our packs is number 50, members. You may proceed, Mr. Vavi.
We're battling to put the presentation up on the screen, but we can speak to it in the meantime, Chairperson. Firstly, we want to thank you and to thank every member of the committee and every party that insisted that the process be opened up and that an extension be granted so that all voices of society could be heard. We are quite grateful to that, and we also are a new player in the market, if we can use the boss's language, and we thought that we did submit in December, but we sent it straight to the wrong door, and we quite grateful that you've allowed us an extension so that we can make a submission. Whilst we say that, maybe I can speak to the presentation in the meantime. This is, in our view, the starting point. This is the fundamental question that we beg you to interact with. What are we trying to do? And what is the context of the intervention you are making at this particular moment, and what are the politics and the ideological pinnings of what we are trying to do? Answering that question, in our view, should be a straightforward matter. It should say to us, we are in the process of a fundamental transformation of our society. We are in the process of changing the balance of forces in society which were stuck against the most marginalized, the black working class. We are in the process of addressing the fault lines we inherited from the colonial and the apartheid era. We are in the process of redress and we are in the process of establishing an equilibrium where we can say in our country there is equity, there is equality, or we move at least towards equality, and there is a better life for all. And that's what I think we should not miss. It's not a discussion just for the sake of having a discussion. It's a discussion to address the past and to make sure that every South African, be they a worker, employed or unemployed, can make sense of the commitments that our constitution make to all of the people of our country. I hope that I can operate this. I see that it's blank.
No, no, you. We have the hard copies with us, so you may proceed.
Oh, let me proceed. One of the historic documents, which we have quoted over and over in our political lives, some of us, is a historic document that was adopted by the ANC in its 1969 conference held in Morogoro. It says a number of things, but in the interest of time, I cannot read everything, but I'm going to hone into the departure point of what we are to talk about today. And it is in the pack, the document that we've circulated to you. And I want to quote this paragraph. It says, our drive towards national emancipation is therefore in a very real way bound up with economic emancipation. We have suffered more than just national humiliation. Our people are deprived of their due in the country's wealth. Their skills have been suppressed, and poverty and starvation has been their experience. And this is the underlying paragraph or sentence we want to bring to your attention. The correction of these centuries old economic injustices lies at the very core of our national aspirations. The correction of these centuries-old economic injustices lies at the very core of our national aspirations. So when we debate a bill today, we cannot forget that we are dealing here with centuries of injustices at the economic level. Now, our presentation speaks about, in very brief, what are these historic injustices at the economic level. We speak about poverty, and which today afflicts 55.5% of the population, which has increased from 53.2% in 2011. So between 2011 and 2015, there has been a rise of 2.3% of people living in poverty in our country. We go and speak in detail about that. Then we speak about unemployment. We point out that the appalling levels of poverty in our country are in the main as a result of the unacceptable levels of unemployment in our economy. We point out that in the last quarter of 2017, unemployment was sitting at 9.2 million of the 55 million South Africans, or a 36.6%. If you use the proper definition of unemployment, that will count all workers that are too discouraged to wake up every morning in search of employment opportunities. We've got to talk about what are the fundamental underlying reasons why we're talking about such levels of unemployment in a country so endowed in terms of economic resources, with the mineral deposits, with the best land, with the best human resource capabilities. Why do we have this? And some would like to believe that the reason why we have this is because employers are not being allowed to pay even lower wages than they are doing already. And this is where we must talk about the ideological construction of the discussion. And let's explain it a little bit, Chairperson. On the left and on the right sits ideologies that are in the opposite to one another. There are others in society who believe that these crises, these levels of poverty, unemployment, inequalities, can only be resolved through interventions of the state to ensure that the business communities have an environment where they can prosper, where they can become big, and where they can grow the economy, and where they can then, out of that, create more opportunities for the unemployed. And we call this ideology, and economists call them a trickle-down approach. Grow the cake, automatically out of that, businesses will employ people, and people will be liberated from poverty inequalities. There's a very, very firm belief in society that this is what you have to do. The state must do nothing else except to create an environment for business to prosper, because there is a belief that out of them making even more greater levels of profits, automatically that will lead to more employment creation by themselves. On the other side of the equation sits another thinking that says, no, whilst we accept that we are living and we are in a capitalist society where 70-80% of everybody employed is employed by the private sector, where 70-80% of all properties are in the hands of private hands. But a state must play a much more meaningful role than just regulating and ensuring that business can prosper and grow the cake, and eventually, we don't know how long the poor must wait, eventually the poor will benefit from much expanded opportunities that business people will provide. There's a belief on the other side that says the state must be an active participant in the economy, must make interventions that will make sure that the spirit of the Constitution that promises us equity is realized and does not happen automatically out of the whims of the private sector. And that growth must happen through redistribution of wealth and redistribution of opportunities. And that state have a role in ensuring that that wealth that must be created is created in such a manner that is not at the back of a further deepening exploitation of the people. And I'm sure here, and I was listening to the NIESA presentation, and I believe that the spirit of these bills is basically informed by the ideology that says the state must allow business to prosper, and out of that prosperity of business, somewhere down the line, the poor will benefit. The problem with that ideology is that we have waited for 24 years already for this trickle-down to happen. It's not happening. And the rich is getting richer, the poor is getting poorer, the unemployed have lesser prospect of getting employed than yesterday, inequalities have grown, to the point that we now the most unequal society in the whole world, and poverty is grinding, and have now reached 55% of the population. We speak about youth unemployment, which we have labeled as a ticking bomb waiting to explode. And those of us who have been monitoring the political events in the past week or so must recognize that there is a growing anger in the South African society. There is a growing sense that the youth have been betrayed by the older generation. And that anger is at a boiling point. The heroes of yesterday are now routinely being labeled the sellouts, the betrayers of the dream of our people. The youth is in search of new dreams. Somewhere 15 years ago, I said that our country's bigger cities are surrounded by a ring of fire. We are the headquarters of demonstrations. The police record that in 1 year, we have 13 to 14,000 demonstrations of the so-called service delivery. At the back of that is these statistics that we casually refer to without attaching the faces and warm bodies to.
Mr. Vavi,
yes.
Can you just take note that you've already spent 14 minutes.
14?
Yes. So we would really like you to zoom into the crux of the business of the day.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. These things are quite emotional, and they are real. Now, here's the crux of the matter, if you want me to talk to it. On page 8, just in conclusion to go past, South Africa is two countries in one. One country have it all, and it is living in opulence, dying of diseases associated with overeating, and the other country of the majority is dying from diseases associated with poverty. Please don't do anything in this portfolio committee that will entrench those two countries in one country. In our view, these bills, look there, Mr. Peter, I can see that you can't see that. If you look at what is on your screens now, you will not be shocked because you would have seen this thing before. The rate of opulence by the few. If you look at the next slide, you will see who are the multi-billionaires that owns 50% of all of the wealth in the country. Now, if you look at our submission, therefore, the issues that we're talking about in that context, the national minimum wage, in our view, the 20 rand, the 18 rand per hour, the 15 rand an hour, the 11 rand an hour, will do nothing, Chairperson, except to entrench the status quo. Already, which is an indictment to all of us, all of those who call themselves liberators, are indicted by the statistics that we saw in 2014 already, that says the median wage in South Africa was at 3,400 rands, which means 50% of South Africa's workers are earning below 3,400 rands already in 2014. I don't know the figures in 2018. This happened despite us standing on the rooftops and making beautiful speeches on Freedom Day, as we are going to do on the 27th, proclaiming that we are free and free at last. That freedom is freedom for some and not freedom for all. And that freedom actually is a statement that spits on the face of the 50% of the workers that earn below those amounts of money. Now, we are being told that we must celebrate, that because there is now a chance to increase that 3,400 to 3,500 if you are lucky to be working 40 hours a week. You will get 3,500. Otherwise, it is 20 rand, it's 15 rand, and it is 11 rand for a worker in the extended public works program. Please address this, because if you don't address this, you cannot talk about a concept of a better life for all in South Africa again. Nor can you insult us by talking about a radical economic transformation in a country with such levels of low pay. The labor amendments, in few minutes, takes away, in our view, the fundamental rights that we have in the constitution of our country. The constitution promises us a right to strike, and the constitution promises us that we can participate in the activities and programs of our organizations freely, without interference from anybody. We can determine our own administration programs, and we can decide what are our activities. These bills seek to undermine, in the main, those two clauses in the Bill of Rights. And we must emphasize that, according to the Constitution, you can only limit those rights if, or only in terms of a law of general application, to the extent that the limitation is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom, taking into account all other factors that are prescribed in the Constitution. We believe that these bills go to the opposite of what is prescribed in the Constitution, and they will be challengeable in the Constitutional Court if you make an intervention that will upset the balance. A lot of people have misled the public freely because they own the means of publishing their propaganda. The reality in South Africa is that the trade union movement is very weak and has been weakened fundamentally. And as we speak, it only represents 24% of the working population. The reality of our country is that 62% of all wages are set through employers acting alone without any negotiations with anybody. And the reality is that only 23% of wages are negotiated through collective bargaining, which Mr. Nyesa was saying that doesn't exist in the African continent, whilst he's sitting right in the tip of the African continent. Only 23% of wages are set through collective bargaining in this country. This exaggerated claim about the power of wages and collective bargaining to undermine employers' possibility of creating employment is just a propaganda that comes from one side. But it is so repeated so frequently that it has now settled as a truth in our country. Only 9% of wages are set through centralized bargaining structures. And 5% of South Africa's workers receive no salary increase of any kind. And 10% receives it infrequently. And that's the crux of the matter, Chairperson, of what we believe you should be addressing.
Please note that you've used 21 minutes, but I'm going to grant you the extra 9 minutes to finish.
So we feel that we must come and say in 1 minute, we are opposed to these attempts to undermine the right to strike. by doing the following, by inserting in the amendment that unions must now arrange, organize at their own expense, at their own logistical capability, secret ballots. We contend that no union have such capacity in this country, whether they are big or small. Insisting that all workers must be secretly balloted and that workers must keep that, or unions must keep that for 3 years, will kill any possibility of any worker ever being in a position to strike in our country today, and therefore will be in a conflict with the Constitution. Secondly, we disagree with the amendment that says there must be notice, strike notices. In fact, we think that that strike notice must be taken out of the current law, including the very idea that workers must be, in the law, they must be forced to ballot as if that's a business of an employer other than the business of the union, itself, in line with the protection that is in the Constitution that says the unions and the employers have a right to manage the administration. The ballot, by the way, is a good thing for mobilizing. Very good. We do that all the time, but what we object to is to give a possibility that an employer can now go to court and say they didn't ballot well, the secret of the ballot was not maintained in all the of the 200 workplaces that you're organizing. We oppose to these notices because they only help to give the employers a notice to say, prepare, they are coming for you. In an unequal relationship that exists in society between the employers and the employees, we disagree with the notion that there must be picketing rules imposed before the strike could commence, and or that a commissioner can impose the picketing rules if there is a disagreement on the parties. We think that this is an open invitation to allow the bosses to dilly-dally, to stonewall, and to frustrate any attempt to reach a speedy agreement ahead of a strike, precisely because they will now know that if you go on a strike without picketing, that strike have a possibility of being not allowed and therefore declared unprotected. We disagree, number four, and the last point, with the point that there must be an extension to the conciliation period. The 30 days already is far too long. Adding another 5 days to the conciliation period, in our view, is intended to achieve what was once said at the public level, that we need a cooling period. Cooling period so that even when there is a clear dispute, you must now wait for 35 days before you can exercise your right to strike. This is intended to make sure that this cooling period actually takes out the anger that is necessary from the workers so that they may give up on their constitutionally guaranteed right to strike. We disagree fundamentally with the insertion of something called advisory arbitration, because this is yet another way of ensuring that any employer can go to the CCMA and ignite this process, a process which the unions are obliged to participate through the yet another consultation, which is good, but it's now in law. You must consult with your members, even though you have a mandate from the Congress that says that this year we are taking forward the following issues at the bargaining councils, so forth and so forth. Now we are being told that there must be a mandate, a fresh mandate, at the point where some employer have gone to court to say this strike is taking for far too long and it is having a huge impact on my firm or in the economy. This is not how you should respond to the Marikana crisis that South Africa faced in 2012. Because all of these laws, by the way, comrades, are a state response to the Marikana massacre, to the fact that the workers in Lonmin went on a 5-month strike demanding a minimum wage of 12,500. When you respond now, you're making it absolutely impossible that those workers must ever have a possibility to take up a battle against their low pay. And this is a state intervention, a capitalist state intervention to disarm the workers, to put their arms behind their backs tied, so that the capital class can do as it wish in the manner that was suggested by Niesa's presentation earlier. Please, instead of doing this, can you take actions, steps that will make sure that we give a meaning to this better life for all, not better life for some, better life for all of the people of South Africa, including the 50% that earns below 3,400. No one amongst us will be subjected or want to wish to be subjected to those levels of pay. Please don't impose them to the marginalized workers, because their voice is far too weak for them to be represented in these chambers of power. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vavi. We noting hands. We have Honorable Mashile. We have the Honorable Bagrim. We have the Honorable Muteka. We have the Honorable Ngwezi. We have the Honorable Madisha, this side. Honorable Teko. Honorable America, in that order. Just remember, honorable members, no preambles. We are looking at clarity-seeking questions, and we allow each member to be restricted to the 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I appreciate the input that has been made by Dr. Vavi. And one is happy that it will also assist us to move forward. But the only few things that I just want to raise for him, maybe he can clarify us, is that in the main submission, when you read it, I think he calls upon us to reject the bills, to throw them in the dustbin. And Chairperson, then I do have a slight problem with that, because in principle, I think we understood that together with Vavi and the rest in the labor unions, the issue of the minimum wage has been our talk. And we have been calling for it. And it is long that we have been speaking about this. And now, I really just want them to explain to us just this principle of introducing the minimum wage. Do they have a problem with it now? Let alone the quantums. And then... Now, going to the bills themselves, and then especially in relation to the minimum wage, is that will they be happy if the minimum wage is implemented as soon as possible, or to be delayed like others that are advocating for the continuous engagement and in principle delaying the implementation of the minimum wage? What is their view from SAFTU? What will they want to see happening? Do they want it to happen immediately? Or do they want to postpone the implementation of this? And do the 50% workers that you speak about willing to stay another month without benefiting to get up to a certain level of better wages? And then the other issue is to explain to ourselves whether we do have the same understanding that we're speaking about the minimum wage. We are not speaking about the living wage. Two little concepts. The minimum wage that we are speaking about, which is the bottom ceiling, where no worker in South Africa should trade the labor and be paid below that particular figure. Are we talking of the same thing?
When you round up, Honorable Mashile.
Yes. And then the issue of balloting. I can hear that you don't want the bosses to know. But why should we have a problem with transparency? If you know the pitfalls of the bosses knowing, doesn't that make you to sharpen the way you do things? And then are you aware that the bill also establishes a commission which would actually advise the minister and also review this minimum wage on an annual basis? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. Honorable Muteka.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I think you have noted the amount of time you have allocated to my colleague.
Sorry, can you repeat?
I think you have noted the time you have allocated to my colleague, the first. This presentation was so progressive, I must say. And again, I appreciate it because it tells us where we come from. From 1969 Morogoro resolutions, and today we're talking of RET, and those things should not be just slogans. They need implementation. And then 24 years of waiting was just more than enough. And I'm also taking a note of the comment from SAFTU on page 11 that says each MP must decide whether he or she wants to perpetuate the status quo. So now, these bills on their current form, SEFF, we said it from the beginning, at their current form, they need to be resent back to NEDLAC, be reviewed and be redone again, because they address nothing about Morogoro 1969 conference. They address nothing about the economic radical economic transformation we all singing about outside there. So what are we addressing if we don't do this? So now I need my question will be in this form. What will be the advice of SAFTU to us as MPs? Because some of us we are minority anyway, so whatever we say might be suppressed by the majority, because some are under pressure of time so that they can take it and pass it as it is against the majority of workers. So what is the advice of SAFTU? Because really, we don't think there's any family that can live with 11 rand an hour, or even 20 rand an hour. There's no family that can live with that. And if really 50%, less than 50% of the workers out there are any less than 3,500 rand, and these things are going to take us even lower than that, what are we trying to address? Who are we representing here? So, but we need advice from your side, because it's your platform. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honorable Muteka. Honorable Bergrim.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe, Mr. Vavi, you can tell me whether you believe you made the statement in the third paragraph that the first 24 years of democracy, it seems to have got worse. Maybe you can just explain that to me. I don't understand it. You've also said that the majority of the workforce now is facing poverty, wages, casualization, and the use of labor brokers. Do you not think that, in fact, a minimum wage will grow that sector as opposed to any other sector? You've also said that, on page 2, that 55.5% of the population live below the poverty line of $9.92 a month in 2015, and it's getting worse. In what way do you think that the minimum wage is going to increase employment? By all accounts, everyone's telling us it's going to decrease employment. Even the Treasury are telling us that. And maybe you can tell us something about it. My colleague also said to you that would you not want this implemented immediately? Are you not saying that you want this sent back to be renegotiated? You weren't part of the initial negotiations. Maybe you want to talk about that as well. Are you aware that there are more people living on some sort of grant, social grant, than there are that are working? And maybe you can comment on that, because we expect that figure to be more in favor of the social grant. In other words, there will be more people then having to access the social grant than that we are working as the population of the working force decreases. One thing I can agree with you, and I disagree with just about everything you have to say, one thing I can agree is that there should be some sort of basic income grant, because even someone trying to get a job can't even get there, and can't even be able to put decent clothes on to be able to make a good impression, so there's a problem there. You say by far the biggest cause of these appalling levels of poverty is the high level of unemployment. Yes, that is true, but what you're saying after that then would create it much bigger. You're actually calling for a minimum of 12,500 Rand per month. I understand that and I understand why, but don't you think that you are now undermining your statement by saying by far the biggest cause of these appalling levels of poverty is high unemployment? You're going to increase that multiple to make it 12,500. There's a give and take in society, and you don't seem to want to understand that or recognize it. I just don't understand that. You say, why has unemployment risen from 94? Well, we know why it's risen from 94. It's just not working, our system, at all. And the system, unfortunately, with the handbrake created by the labor legislation, is making that a lot worse. What I found interesting is you said the expanded unemployment rate for this age group, you're talking about the youth, is now at a staggering 63.8%. Well, you've taught me something, that's for sure. I didn't know it was that bad. It's going to get worse, because who's going to take in someone that's not going to give them more than what they're paying them? No one.
Can you round up, Honorable Bay?
Well, I've got about 30 questions here, Madam Chair, and again, I need to say that SAFTU has got a voice in our community, has got a voice in South Africa. They're an important voice. And if I can't put my questions to them, then we're not testing it. Then we're just sitting here stuffed shirts. And the reality is, this is just, as again, my colleague, Mr. America, had said, that we're sitting here just to go through a motion and to make sure this goes through. So, in fact, Mr. Vavi didn't need to even come and speak to us. We're not going to listen to him anyway. But thank you. I will round up.
Honorable Bergrim, just to re-emphasize to you, we have other honorable members in the committee, and it's only fair that we give you equal opportunity to respond. We can't give the one freeway and the others we are limiting. Otherwise, we're going to sit here until whenever. And we know that's not the solution. Honorable Ngwezi.
Thank you very much, Chair. For the first time, Chair, I will agree in most of the things that were presented by Honorable Vave. Now that he leads an independent union, independent from any political party, I agree with him in some of the your presentation, in most, in fact. But, Chair, some points have been taken by the previous speakers. I just want to find out from SAFTO if their feeling really is that the way in which we want to implement this bill, these bills are wrong, and we should actually stop the implementation. And mind you, I think if we stop, if we're stopping, the damage outside there is not waiting for us. It's continuing. So I just want to find if their feeling is that we should stop the implementation of the proposal we're making. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Ngwezi. Honorable Madisha.
The problem. Thank you, Chair. Permit one to welcome the proposals from the Federation that were put before us. I mean, as South Africans, all of us, we do agree that workers no longer join unions. I mean, that is a fact in South Africa at the moment. And this is due to the fact that employers don't back them. Can you say something on that? Because it is very necessary. We are talking about this thing of the increments, etc., and people are simply left outside. You can't say anything because, after all, you cannot rise as a trade union to say this and that has got to happen, etc. Can you say something around that? And may I say that this is, in my opinion, ossified by the point that you have put on page 13. I think that is the last paragraph. Okay. Number two, it is a fact that unemployment rate has risen to 40% in the country at the moment. Albeit some in government and some around wish to disagree. Now, that is a fact. And of course, there is empirical evidence that can be given that we do have that kind of a problem. Are you able to say something around that? It is a fact, again, that many in the 60% who are employed, remember, it's 40% unemployed and 60% employed. Now, this 60%, we're talking about workers from, for example, from outside of South Africa, from Lesotho, etc., who work in the mines, and they are just willing to take anything. Whatever you give them, they just take. Why? Because they fear that unless they do that, there will be a problem. We're talking here about the labor relations and those changes. Would you mind to say this is what we think should be done? So you have 40% employed, you have 60% unemployed, but then even these who are unemployed are persons who are not given any salaries but tips. Go to restaurants, for instance, around, you find poor people, workers there, who are not given a salary, but who depend on tips. Have you looked into that? That's a major problem. We say here that there needs to be an increment, but is there going to be an increment in tips? Now, that's another major problem that I would propose the federation here has got to say. Again, it is a fact that, and I'm happy you have raised that, that it's only a few people who are getting very large, you know, amounts of salary. You have cited, and you are correct, the president of the country, who gets 1,250 rand per hour. You, 1,250
per hour. Honorable Madisha, can you please round up?
Now what do you do? What must we do about that? Because these are major problems that we're faced with in the country. I therefore am saying I agree with the proposals that you have given, but then the issue of implementation.
What's happening there? Can we please allow the Honorable Madisha to round up, please?
If you could just aside as I close, there are very many issues that one has still here. Because we are talking about the rise in what workers have got to get, etc., etc., why are you not allowed to participate in the illegal, in the in Netlag, etc., etc.? Please do raise that so that from this particular level, we are able to talk about that. Yes, he has indicated, but then I want you to put it legally, not legally, but here in front of this constitutional structure of government. Why are you not allowed? Please do indicate that.
Thank you, Honorable.
But then I want
Madisha
to indicate that I have understood and do agree with the points that you have put. Our people are suffering and we can't allow that.
Thank you very much. Honorable Teko.
Thanks, Chair. There are three or four questions that I have. Firstly, I will say the intention of the bill, when it was introduced, it was to make sure that we bridge the gap between the lower paid and the other ones. So that's why there is this bill in front of us, the national minimum wage, not the living, it's not a living wage. We saw it as a necessity that we have as a country to have somewhere where we need to start. However, when I recall back, on the 24 years that you are saying, it was the, you, we, this, they were regressing. At one point, you were part of it. You were taking decision on behalf of the country. And here we are as a government. We are saying we need to start somewhere. We need to address the inequality and the unemployment that is on the ground. What is your take on this one? And the bill itself, we are saying four, we have identified things for balloting, picketing, arbitration. You have listed, I think it's four. In principle, according to what I'm saying, what you have take out on the bill to say this is not what you are in agreement with. To me, you are telling me that you are, in principle, you are agreeing, but you are using this thing of saying you don't want to agree. You are rejecting the bill because it's us who are bringing the bill in front of to reduce the unemployment of the people, because the bill seeks to address that issue. Or at least 6 million people, when we do assessment, they are going to benefit on this introduction of this. So the issue that the 5% and the 10% is this part of people that were saying they must not in their entire life benefit from this, or what I also need to get that clarity to say. We just have to take this to the dustbin. We don't want the government to make interventions. You have another way of assisting the inequality and the unemployment. I really had to get that to say, what is it that you are trying to tell us? Because the NEDLAC, people have participated on the NEDLAC. Unfortunately, you, in principle, I think I will say you also formed part of the NEDLAC before. You participated. It's just now you are on the other side. You are as a party that you were not given as a party to participate. But I will say the Freedom Charter, you were there. You were on the ground saying this is what we need. This is the bill that seeks to address the freedom. So in a, you just the question directly would be, are you in support of the bill or not? And secondly, the 20 rand you think is not good enough for us to start, because this thing will be reviewed annually. So according to you, we must not even start. You must not do anything. I think that's what I need you to clarify for me, to say for us to bridge this, you are not giving us no way to say, no, don't do it. I'm rejecting with the content it deserves. So this, I think, is some of the things. The 3.5, we have done our assessment as government. But we're not saying it won't improve. This is a start. Come, everybody must come on board. We need to address this inequality, all of us. This is a new dawn. The business confidence has gained. And we are saying we won't, no one is going to lose any job with this process. So come tell us this is what you think. I need to get that and you clear that thing to say we must just take it out. We are not in agreement with
that. Thank you, Honorable Teko. Honorable America.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Valvi, for the presentation. It makes for some interesting reading. Somehow, in certain sections, it is rather alarmist and sensationalist, but they're all welcome. So, I appreciate the fact that you have very clearly set out the unemployment reality in South Africa, and that you have put it in different sort of segments and sort of stratified it quite well, and I think for many of us who were not aware, it's a welcome sort of presentation. Then you also touched on inequality, and I'm somewhat disappointed in terms of how you framed inequality in the presentation. I think there's more to that than simply just the gap between the highest paid worker and the lowest paid, and you know there's more to it, but for the sake of brevity, I suppose you omitted to leave that out. What I do fail to understand, Mr. Vavi, is that I don't get a sense that there's a dialectical link between those two concepts, the unemployment that you've raised, inequality, and your demand for a living wage for 12,500, and how it will mitigate and counter those two concepts. So maybe you could expand it, because as my colleague has stated, that there will be a tsunami of unemployment if we would ever even consider your demand of a 12,500
minimum wage at this stage. And lastly, Madam Chair, there's many others, but I think that there are technical matters that can be addressed. That you express your objection in terms of the resolution with disputes with regard to the national minimum wage, and particularly the length of time the CCMA would deal with those matters. But you have not given us an alternative as to how you think it need to be dealt with, and maybe you could just expand on that. And lastly, if I may, Madam Chair, is that we know that in terms of the South African reality, that people have given up looking for jobs, and it's a very sad indictment on us. There are so many young people out of jobs that have left school, that have left university or college or whatever. They simply just cannot find employment. And as you correctly stated, it's a ticking time bomb. And we need to find a way of getting them into the employment system. And we as a Democratic Alliance are proposing for those young people who have been out of employment for 2 years that they should be granted an exemption certificate to enter the labor market for a limited period of time that enable them as individuals to negotiate their own employment remuneration package and benefits of service.
Can you round up, Honourable America?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we had our opportunity to interrogate the submission. We noticed that we have members of the public in our gallery. We want to welcome you to Parliament. We are the Portfolio Committee of Labour, and we are busy with public hearings towards the introduction of a national minimum wage, whereby we are listening at different stakeholders, presenting to the committee members their views and concerns in terms of the proposed amendments to the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, as well as the Labour Relations Act, and as well as the introduction of the new minimum wage bill. So you are welcome here. We have currently on the floor the General Secretary of SAFTU, a trade union federation, and the members have just deliberated on his proposal, and we are going to give him the opportunity to respond now. Mr. Vavi, thank you.
Let me thank you all members of Parliament for asking quite detailed, engaging questions. We will do our best to engage with them. They're quite substantial questions, but I will try to be brief so that I bear into account your predetermined of a time. The honourable colleague from the ANC is asking what are we asking? Are we agreeing in principle? Are we rejecting everything that is on the table? And I think a number of other colleagues have asked a similar question. Let me explain this, honourable members. The principle of a national minimum wage we support. Let there be no confusion. The principle we support, and let me correct you, the principle was only agreed to even in the context of a COSATU in response to the Marikana massacre and in response to the workers of the Durance who on their own took up a battle against the 67 rand a day sectoral determination demanding 115 rands a day. Only in response to that was there consensus, at least in COSATU, that there must be a national minimum wage. I now refer to the original. before they capture the original Cosatu. And everybody will then know what then happened in consequence.
Mr. Vavi, can I please request you, let's be in order. Can we stick to the subject matter and not venture into politics? Because we're going to get to a point where we're going to provoke each other, and we don't want to see that situation, please.
I withdraw that one. But I was trying to give a background, because there was then another question similar to that later as to... So the principle is okay. What we are objecting to is the levels. And we believe that the levels do three things. They entrench poverty, they entrench inequalities, they entrench the apartheid wage structure, and will do nothing to the opposite of those things. And that's why we think that the 20 rand, 15 rand, 11 rand, and 18 rand for farm workers an hour is representing insult and a move to the opposite direction of a better life for all that Comrade Nelson Mandela promised us. So that's the issue. That's the crux of the issue, not the initial minimum wage bill. What are we saying? We are saying that the bill must be sent back to NEDLAC, and it must be engaged with by all, including those that are now being excluded, which is SAFTU. Is a delegation of SAFTU here, I should have said, representing the most marginalized workers in society. Because that's what SAFTU is. It's not a big public sector unions federation. It's the union of farm workers, of commercial catering hotel workers, where the levels of penetration of unions remains absolutely low. And they are startup unions, small 5, 10, 5,000, the 30 of them. But they represent a step to the right direction in the context of the extent to which the unions have been fragmented in our country. The Department of Labor told us already in 2016 in February that there are 182 registered unions in our country. It's a crisis. So that's what we try to do. We have been excluded, honorable members, from NEDLAC. You remember when we talk about Robert Sobukwe, we usually complain that during the apartheid era there was an immediate passing of a special law to ensure that Robert Sobukwe stays in prison forever. It was popularly known as the Robert Sobukwe Clause. In NEDLAC, there is a special clause designed for SAFTU. It was passed in a hurry in January, when SAFTU was to be launched in April. And this clause says any federation that wants to apply for membership in NEDLAC must have existed for more than 2 years and must produce audited statement for that period. Because SAFTU will only be 1 year old on the 21st of April, that supposed SAFTU clause will keep us out until the 21st of April, 2019. Let me remind you, the real reason why Marikana happened is because the mine workers there, sold out by their traditional union, felt unrepresented in the bargaining structures, and they found solutions outside the tent rules, or the rules of the tent. These narrow-minded people, for factional reasons, are excluding almost 800,000 workers, the second biggest federation in the country today, the only growing one in the context of a complete fall of membership of others. They are excluding it outside bureaucratically and waiting for the bomb to happen. The first bomb is happening on the 25th of April because we are having a general strike, which will not be something that we have seen recently from the captured federation. It will be different because we represent the genuine interest of workers in the country. And that's the price they are prepared to pay. So we're asking you, now that you are raising that issue, please speak to the colleagues. There's nothing to fear from a trade union that proclaim and wants to practice the principle of independence, but not apolitical. The principle of truly democratic, worker-controlled, not manipulated by the leadership who are queuing up to go to parliament. And the principle of campaigning and fighting union movement in the context of the picture that we have painted. So we are appealing to you, please take these bills back to NEDLAC on condition that no one will be locked outside and that NEDLAC will accept that there are different views, and some of the different views come from federations like the one that we represent today. In relation to the, so I've clarified that point is clarified for all of the other leaders who have asked the same question. What is the issue of the 50% in the national minimum wage? This is the crux of the matter of the introduction of our introduction. In the introduction, we are asking you to reject the status quo. Don't say you are fundamentally restructuring power relations in society in favor of the motive forces were on the receiving end of the apartheid colonial capitalism mismatch by playing in the periphery, interventions in the periphery, in a manner that in the overall chairperson will keep that status quo of low wages, of poverty wages, of the apartheid wage structure. We are asking you to dismantle the apartheid wage structure and replace it with the concept that I thought was adopted by the ANC in 2007, decent work for all people of the country, decent life and decent work. And there's no decency in the 20 rand an hour or 11 rand an hour for the extended public works workers. So we do understand the concept. We're putting the 12,500 because the 12,500 have become such an emotional issue for South African workers, my leaders. 12,500 is what led to the state to organize mortuaries and 2,000 round of live ammunition so that 34 mine workers can be mercilessly and brutally killed whilst they have their hands up pleading for their lives in Marikana. So the 12,500 it is they who put it firmly on the agenda of workers. But let's talk about a decent life. The University of Cape Town, way back in 2014, says to South Africa, for a worker who supports 5 dependents to survive, just to keep their heads above the water, that worker will need a 5,400 rands a month. These figures are way below the minimum living level, way below. It's entrenching poverty, but glorifying within the concept, comrade leader, of a better half a loaf is better than nothing. We will be liberating 6 million. From what to what? From a life of below 3,400 to a life of 20 rands an hour. The 3,500 doesn't exist. It's not in the bill. It's a propaganda. What is in the bill is 20 rand. You will only get 3,500 if you work every day, 40 hours a week. If you don't work like that, you won't get 3,500. You'll get below. And here is the CEO of BUSA, who have said in public, all they are going to do as the employers now is to decrease the number of hours so that they may not even pay 3,500 and pay below that, because the 3,500 is not what is being entrenched. What is entrenched is 20 rand, 18 rand, 15 rand, 11 rand an hour. Can't you see that this is about perpetuating the status quo and making it a permanent feature of not only the labor market, but also of the of the South Africa that we say must be a new South Africa. The ballot and the bosses. There is a ballot in the current law. We must say this. But this bill put further stumbling blocks. It entrenched that ballot. We have a problem with it already. But it then says the ballot must be secret. It says the ballots must be kept for three years. And it says that the unions must have the responsibility of organizing the ballots, the secret ballots. The point we're making, Chairperson, is that not even NUMSA, with its 360,000 workers, have capacity to organize secret ballot. Just imagine a secret ballot in each and every garage. 20 garages around town here, or 50 around Cape Town in total. No union have capacity. Now think about a union that only have 4,000 workers or 100 workers. Where does it have capacity to put together boxes and to arrange that in the workplace, that workers one by one go to the box with a ballot paper, just like the IEC do? Doesn't have that capacity. This is a way of killing the strike. It's intended to make sure that no worker will be able to go on a protected strike again. That's what this thing is about, and that's why we're saying it's the worst assault. It's the most frontal assault on the rights of workers in particular. Comrade Matisha says the numbers of workers belonging to unions is on a decline in South Africa for many reasons. But wait until these bills are enacted into law. Why workers must belong to a unions that can't even strike? What are they for? Insurance companies. That's what they are going to be reduced to. They will be organizing pap and flays, braai, just like the Chinese unions are doing in China. Please don't do this, comrades. You can't go down in history as the people who emasculated the working class in this country. And I'm talking to you, all of you, irrespective of your political differences. You don't want to go down in your history as the MPs that intervened in a class battle and disarmed the workers and made them vulnerable in the context of their continued brutalization and deepening class exploitation. Please don't do this. Now, my comrade EFF Mutega, you raises issues. Thank you very much for commanding us. And yes, this is a progressive intervention. Yes, Morogoro is what we believe in. It is whether we are dismissed, we chased out, but that's what the ideology is, because it is a correct ideological stance that to think that you want to resolve the contradictions in our society by perpetuating the status quo is not a revolution. It is a regression. It is entrenching. It is keeping about the status quo intact at the expense of the motive forces of the revolution. We are opposed to the big rush to pass the laws, and we welcome, by the way, the fact that the implementation date have been postponed. It was meant to be the 1st of May. The very day we're supposed to be celebrating international rights of workers was supposed to be the day that we're taking an assault in South Africa. Thank you for postponing that, and we can only hope that the next step will be for you to listen to our pleas and to reverse these the elements that I'm still going to just emphasize in response to the questions. My leader from the DA, thank you very much for the comments, and thanks very much for insisting that the bill be opened up and for inputs from our side. We hear that even in the media. We quite appreciate that. Thanks for being honest. We disagree fundamentally on the ideology. I've explained that. But I'd rather deal with an honest disagreement than a pretender who pretends to be walking with me when he's carrying a knife and pushing it behind my back. Because when we have an open disagreement, there's a chance that we can have a dialogue and hopefully convince one another. Now, we highlighted the crisis of poverty, unemployment, inequalities, because we don't want them divorced from this discussion. In our view, they form part and parcel of the discussion. We disagree with you when you say this bill will worsen the unemployment in our country in this way. And yes, South Africa's structural problem of unemployment, and I know you will disagree. The reason why South Africa unemployment has not been broken is because we inherited a growth path from the apartheid era that simply reproduces unemployment, poverty, and inequalities. We were too scared to confront the bull by its horns, to do the right things of changing the structure of the economy and get us out of this massive dependency we have as a country from the mining, finance, and heavy chemicals complex. We didn't industrialize. We wanted to be the good boys of the world. We went even before the World Trade Organization existed to GATT in Singapore in 1993 and made a commitment that we're going to remove all tariffs even faster than what was required by the World Trade Organization. We said we must be open up to the chilly winds of competition. That's what Trevor Manuel told us when he was the Minister of Trade and Industry. Disaster period, in our view. And deindustrialization started at that moment, not under Zuma or the past 10 years. That's where people are making a mistake. Deindustrialization and worsening unemployment started at the moment when we refused to use our mining advantage, our mineral advantage, to industrialize, to build secondary industries, to beneficiate, yeah, and to bring the resources of the country in the use of all of the people of the country. Because that was not popular in Washington and in New York. So unemployment in South Africa, amongst others, is driven by the fact that the apartheid system created labor reserves in the bandstands deliberately uneducated, unskilled, so that they can provide cheap labor to the mines and to the farms. And that is what we are trapped in today. Sorry.
Okay. We appreciate the information that you are giving, but we unfortunately can give you only 2 minutes to wrap up.
As long as you have 50% of workers in our country trapped at 3,400 rands, it will mean that you have 50% of the population of workers outside the economy. They can't buy irons, they can't buy refrigerators, they can't buy cars that are being produced by other workers. And that's what is driving unemployment in the country. It's because there are far too many people who cannot buy, who cannot be participants in the economy. This bill is going to keep that going if you pass. And that's basically the point of departure. There are so many other questions, Chairperson. I now understand your pressure.
What we can allow is that you wrap up in the next minute, and the rest of the questions that you didn't get to, you can forward it via written replies.
We'll welcome that. We will do that. We will do that. We will do that. I've already answered quite a number of questions from Comrade Madisha, the president of COSATU. Just the concluding part with
the previous president of COSATU.
Once a president, always a president. Comrade Tego of the ANC. This is not a breach. This is an entrenchment of the status quo. a bridge at least will be talking to the minimum living level that I referred to earlier. And if we were to, we will engage with you in detail in relation to how this is an entrenchment, and that the promise that this will change very soon is to make us to accept this as a permanent feature of the labor market in South Africa. I've explained the history of this. COSATU never agreed to the national minimum wage. There was always divisions. From 1985, the only point that made COSATU unions to unite was Marikana massacre, because the Marikana massacre was such an eventful political systemic occurrence that everything had to be put under review. And one of those was the national minimum wage. And that's why COSATU for the first time supported it. But then once we took that resolution, there was a tsunami inside COSATU that threw some of us out. Hundreds and thousands of us. Don't look at me and say, Vavi. Look at the hundreds and thousands of workers who were thrown out because they were demanding that unions must be independent and mustn't be used for as political tools by any political party. So don't say, Vavi. Say hundreds and thousands of workers who used to fight for this national minimum wage are now out in the streets and were thrown out through political shenanigans.
On that note, I think I want to thank Mr. Vavi for his responses, and we are waiting the
reply. We will do that. Replies. We want to thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, for being so patient with us.
Indeed.
We appreciate that. I wanted to introduce just the Deputy President of SAFTU, Nomvume Kgalakgala, and she is a worker in the Western Cape as a social development, but behind her, there are workers from other transport workers, farm workers, and the provincial secretary of SAFTU here in the Western Cape, also a victim of shenanigans in SAMU. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. On that note, we will have the next presenters, Agri SA, represented by Ms. Yani de Villiers. Can you introduce also your team with you? And the floor is yours.
Madam Chair, is it in order if while we're busy I can just introduce my team? Okay, thank you very, very much for the opportunity. I'm Head of Labour and Development at AgriSA, and the people accompanying me are Mr. André Bloem and Ms. Annelies Crosby, are also both from AgriSA. Thank you very much for that. Now, I've prepared a PowerPoint presentation, because we've actually condensed the documents in front of the Portfolio Committee into 5 slides, because much has changed since the first time we made our submission. And then on a lighter note, my colleague did point out that I am matching the chamber today. I take note. It's my first time in front of the Portfolio Committee. I think I was just as wide-eyed as everybody was sitting in the public gallery. So thank you for the indulgence. Now, as far as this goes, I think I'm just going to continue for the sake of time. The presentation will basically give an overview money-wise, wage-wise, what is going on in agriculture at the moment. And then what we're also looking at is just some of the possible challenges that we are going to see with regards to the implementation of the national minimum wage and just the way that AgriSA sees things moving forward. Thank you so much for that.
Honourable members, please take note that we've just received that PowerPoint presentation and it's been forwarded to you as a soft copy now.
There we go. Thank you very much. Okay, first things first. I just wanted to start with the current situation in agriculture. I hope that you can see the current sectoral minimum wage is 16 rand 25 per hour. Now, agriculture has been granted in terms of the bill a 90% of the national minimum wage. We are currently on about 81.25% of the 20 rand per hour proposed minimum wage. If wages increase next year by roughly 6%, now just as a side note, wages in the agricultural sector normally don't increase just by inflation. We have inflation plus additional percentage points. So we were just looking at an estimate roughly of 6%, then in 2019 we would have moved up to 17 rand 23 per hour, which is about 86% of the proposed national minimum wage. Now, the sectoral minimum wage, and that's the only point I wanted to make with this, is not far behind what government is proposing in the bill. Now, with regard to that, the challenges that we foresee with this, in the first point, we are actually in the province that is going to feel the largest effect of this first point, which is the drought. It has hit a province which is very labor intensive when it comes to farm work, because, I mean, as you are all aware, from commodity to commodity, it differs. A sheep farm, for instance, will not have as many workers as a grape farm will. This province has felt this drought very, very acutely, and we just feel that the timing of the implementation of the national minimum wage is absolutely crucial given what's going on in our industry. Now, we have a sectoral determination. I probably should have started with this. Agriculture has a minimum wage. We have a minimum wage. We have minimum conditions of service. We have a very detailed sectoral determination. And as AgriSA, from AgriSA's side, we are 100% committed to compliance with that sectoral determination. I've been involved with agriculture for a short period of time, but long enough to have contact with the Department of Labor as well. And just to make it very, very, very clear that when it comes to issues of non-compliance, AgriSA has zero tolerance, and where these issues are brought to our attention, we investigate immediately and work very closely with the department as well. Now, as I say, the sectoral determination is very, very detailed. It does allow certain allowable deductions within that sectoral determination as well. An agreement was reached at NEDLAC that the sectoral determinations will not be repealed, but there has been confusion about that. So from our side, we would just like clarity with regard to the sectoral determinations and the lifespan that these are going to have, because we also don't want a situation where there are people who are spreading disinformation, which I think is just probably an effect of a process that has taken a very long time. No criticism at all. It's just, unfortunately, one of the byproducts we're sitting with, and we would prefer to advise our members correctly from the start. Now, exemptions, for instance. I said previously we've condensed the document in front of you. Exemptions were initially identified as a challenge, but I see Mr. Mkalipi sitting here as well. We have been engaging through NEDLAC, through our membership of BUSA, with regard to the exemption process. And I believe very strongly in giving credit where it's due as well. There is a team looking at the exemption process. It's actually drawn organized agriculture in as well to the extent that they've been to us. I believe that the exemption process is an area that we can continue engaging on, especially within the regulations and the process that's currently being followed at NEDLAC. So even though we initially identified this as a challenge, I believe that through constructive engagement, we will reach a stage where all our members know exactly how exemptions will work. Now, with regard to challenges, let me see, is it going to... When it comes to the clauses within the National Minimum Wage Bill that speak to claims for failure to pay the National Minimum Wage, our members brought to our attention and asked us to bring to your attention that it could lead to forum shopping. We want a situation within agriculture, and look, I speak for my sector, but I do believe that the sentiment is carried broadly. We want clear regulations, clear law, plain language, understandable, so that our members know exactly what they need to do. We don't want a situation where there can be costly, unnecessary forum shopping. We support a very clear, concise process through the CCMA, possible review to the Labour Court, the way that things are currently in our Labour Law framework. Now, I believe this is the last point, second to last point I wanted to mention. The proposed four-hour working day was also identified as a challenge. We have situations in our sector, especially when you look at seasonal workers, where people are being fetched for work at the cost of the employer. I'm specifically speaking about instances where the employer bears these costs. The transport costs are paid, but the weather conditions don't necessarily allow for work to be performed on that day. Please bear in mind that 80% of farmers are SMEs. They are going to, in those circumstances, be paying twice for exactly the same work. It is something that was brought to our attention by our members that they feel quite strongly about. We don't want a situation where we have that kind of burden on an employer as well. Now, in the initial impact assessment that was done, I believe this was done by the National Minimum Wage Research Initiative of Wits University, they made mention of the fact that they estimated at that stage job losses of between 205,000 and 897,000. We've heard extensively this morning what the situation is with unemployment in our country. Agriculture does not want to contribute to these statistics. Our members do not want to be in a situation where job losses are caused because of very, very high input costs, of which labor is one. That is just something that we need to bring to your attention, because we feel very strongly within our sector as well that we need to be part of the solution of our country. We cannot be in a situation where all of us sit here and all of us have jobs. I have a salary at the end of the month, as does every single person in this room. And we are speaking of people who might not. And we are shrugging our shoulders and saying, we don't know, we will see. We find that unacceptable. Now, within this research document, and Madam Chair, I see I didn't forward the entire research document because I didn't want to encumber the committee even more. If I need to forward this, please just indicate it to me, and I definitely will do that. Now, in this research document, it is indicated under groups that will bear the costs or lose. In the table, it states that research on the impact of the minimum wage in the sectoral determination of South Africa has found that adjustments have not had significantly negative employment effects except for agriculture. Our sector is vulnerable when it comes to this. Now, forestry operations, I've made mention of quite a few different aspects, different commodities, different kinds of farming, have increasingly looked towards mechanization. And the reason for that is rising labor costs, as well as keeping up with the rest of the world when it comes to technological advances. This is a very real risk, and we would be amiss if we didn't bring that to the committee's attention as well. Now, finally, what we propose, because we want to be part of the solution, I said that right in the very beginning, we propose an extended phasing-in period. As you saw, with regard to our sectoral minimum wages, we are not far behind. We believe we will catch up. Our sector is comfortable with paying a minimum wage. It is not a foreign concept to our sector at all. But we believe just by giving us a little bit of time, or a little bit more time, be able to get to a point where we are all paying in accordance with the national minimum wage. Now, the second point would be the option of continuing wage increases in accordance with the sectoral determination, that at least be investigated. And we feel very strongly that the terms and conditions of our sectoral determinations be retained. Now, in our initial submission, you would have seen a very large emphasis on forestry and sawmilling as well. I didn't put any emphasis on that today because Forestry South Africa has already been to the committee and made their submission. So suffice to say that we absolutely support the submission that was made by Forestry South Africa as one of our members as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. de Villiers. Members, there we have it. I'm noting hands. We have the Honourable Bagram, the Honourable Muteka, the Honourable Mashile in that order. The floor is yours. Then, Honourable Madisha? Yeah, Honourable Madisha. Honourable Bagram.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it, and thank you, Mr. Villiers. Just, you would have seen, obviously, that the sectoral determinations are destined to disappear completely, and that would actually, over a period of time, of course, and that would, to a large degree, destroy some of the benefits across the board. And I want your comment on that, because it's an industry that is quite complicated. Many people live on the farms, they get the food from the farms, they get transport, churches, etc., etc., and I want your comments on that. Clearly, I disagree with it, that it should go. The other thing is that the unions are telling us, many of the unions are telling us, that... And in fact, we didn't hear that from SAFTU today. I was quite surprised. But the other unions are telling us that you've got to be very careful not to denude the value of the 20 Rand. In other words, they're saying the increases that must come thereafter must be keeping up with the same buying power. And they wanted that underlined in that payment. Despite the fact that we didn't hear it today, it has been said. You saying, on the other hand, you want more time in which to implement it, and I just wanted your comments on that. You then do say in your presentation that we did get on paper that the bill to a certain extent will have the opposite effect of economic development and social justice, and maybe you could expand just a little bit on that. A lot of the industries in farming sector, sawmilling and whatever, a lot of those attached industries, could to a large degree mechanize and computerize. I recently went to a farming operation where everything's run by computer and mechanization, and in fact a farm that used to have a few hundred people has now got a few dozen people. At what point do you say, well, it's not worth it anymore, let's rather mechanize, we don't need staff? It's something that we can ill afford in South Africa. We need to protect jobs, even to the extent of mechanizing and computerizing and going into that fourth industrial revolution. And maybe you can comment on that to us. The Democratic Alliance has argued for a long time now that we must look very carefully at each sector, and we should, in fact, basically look at the sector and then say, let's have a national minimum wage, not a uniform national minimum wage, but a national minimum wage per sector. In other words, bring in the one-third of the workforce that have got no minimum wage at all. We say bring them in, because some sectors, 20 Rand per hour would be denuding their real value. In fact, they should be getting 100 Rand per hour. And not the 20 Rand, and that's what we're saying in the Democratic Alliance. Let's look at this sector, let's understand it, let's see what people need, and let's see what can be sustainable. And maybe you want to comment on that. I know at the end of the day you did say that, and you attacked the idea that the minimum wage must exclude any payment in kind, including board and accommodation. Yours is one industry that speaks to that point very strongly. Very, very strongly. The exemptions, just quickly to have a look at this, the exemptions are going to be a real problem, because already we know from experience over the past 20 years that getting exemptions from the bargaining councils has been almost impossible to a large degree. And I strongly disagree with some of my union brothers and colleagues with this, that the exemptions should be actually legislated. A proper process should be put into legislation. We can't risk putting it into the hands of just a minister with some regulations. And I wanted to have your comment on that, because you're saying there's confusion and miscommunication. I want you to actually try and expand a bit on how one qualifies for an exemption, and shouldn't that be in legislation so that we can all talk about it instead of leaving it up to one individual somewhere down the line. Where I don't agree with you is the claims for failure to pay any amount, 2.4 in your written document, although we don't have the capacity at this point, I would suggest that the CCMA probably is the best route to look at somehow trying to sort this out. If we have to wait for courts or some other route, it's going to take years to sort out.
And I think Mr. Begum, can you please wrap proven. Up?
I am wrapping. Sorry, Madam Chair, but again, I'm not even halfway through. You said in terms of Clause 16, there'll be no obligation on the Minister to publish alterations to draft regulations. Again, that speaks to my point. And maybe you want to comment on that. Shouldn't we, as a Parliament, at least have some say into how those regulations should be put together and what must be in them? And it will be subject to a constitutional challenge in due course. We all know that. In terms of the acknowledgement of the importance of food and job security, I don't think there's been any acknowledgement at all, especially in terms of job security. Everyone's missed out on speaking for the unemployed. No one speaks for the unemployed. We haven't had anyone telling us anything about that over here. You've called for allowable deductions of 10%. Again, I would agree with that, but maybe you can talk to that. Just in terms of, and you didn't address us on the sawmilling industry at all, but that's one industry in particular that all you need to do is buy one or two machines, have one or two people, and you can have 500 people out of their jobs. Maybe you want to comment on that as
Thank
well.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Modeka.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let's welcome the presentation from AgriSA. Chairperson, we all agree that not all companies can be treated the same. We know there are very little poor ones, there are very rich ones, big ones, and all that. We understand that principle. But now, the AgriSA is here telling us that please give us a little bit of time. We are not ready and like that. And then my question is, how long is this little bit of time? Because this time has been there from 1994 to today. If you can visit the farm workers where they stay and where they work, you'll cry for yourself. And then go and check where the employers are staying in very luxury properties, not even one, more than that. But I'm just giving you a situation because I'm coming to talk about exemption. So this exemption qualification should be, the requirements should be very strict. As I said in the previous meetings, it should be very strict to the extent of the honest and audited financial statements coming so that they can justify how they qualify for the exemption. We have seen these things and really our sisters and brothers are working for these farmers. And they are really suffering. And you find their employers enjoying it. But when you talk of increment, let's take an example of the previous negotiations of the denominations. The demand was at 150, if my memory is still good. And they cried, 150 rand a day. Not even an hour a day. They cried till it went down to 105 rand, if I'm correct. But still, we were still threatened by the thing of there will be loss of jobs. There will be loss of jobs. So every time you're saying, can we share a little bit to the workers? There's this thing of saying, if you say he must have a living or for working for me, then I'll send him home. So he mustn't get a living out of this work, which is giving me money to live better. Otherwise, I take him home if he one day. So I'm just putting that picture in front of everyone so that we can understand. But I'm not saying 12,500 even for the farm workers, even for, no. Because other people, when we talk, they twist these things as if we are irrelevant bodies. We understand. We understand we are not same size. We can be, but the same size. But the strict requirements are needed so that we know really this company qualifies for the exemption. We cannot be abused like people are asking for the exemption to slave our people and live a better life on their own. Thanks very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Muteka, the Honorable Matish, Honorable Schle.
Chairperson, it's all over. I think Vavi spoke about the transformation. Now I just want to put this question to AgriSAs. Do you really want to make a meaningful contribution to this transformation in the agricultural sector that the workers there can benefit in the face of conditions that they find themselves in there? As my colleague from EFF has indicated, that workers on the farms are living in barracks, but the bosses are living in luxurious houses in there, driving 4x4s. And almost every Friday, they are having squash and drinking liquor, in majority. I drive through Kippersall almost every Friday, the Kippersall farms, and I see these people on the side of the road when they are struggling to go to Hazyview around 6 o'clock to go home. Does AgriSA wants to make a meaningful contribution in the transformation of that sector in the manner that also the workers benefit from them? That's the one question that I'm asking. And then, as one is understanding the issues of exemption, of course, it's anybody would not want to shock the industry. But then, as we are putting the minimum wage, it's a question that I did not have time to ask to Comrade Vav, is that the minimum wage is different from living wage. And then being different is that the unions will still have a right to bargain for living wage if they believe that the minimum wage is not adequate for the specific sector where their workers are working. Will you then accept them to negotiate higher wages, pursuing living wage in the presence of the minimum wage that would have been introduced? Now, the third question is that if you were in my shoes as a politician here, you then hear Comrade Vavi talking about the minimum wage of 12,500. You then hear somebody in Cape Town University talking about 5,400. Then you then hear NEDLAC talking about 3,500. What would be your proposal if you were me, this side, to ensure that whatever you propose then deal with the poverty that we are trying to intervene in? Non-compliance when you have sanctions for those that are not complying, surely the reason is to stop them from not complying. The easiest way is to comply. Then you don't face the wrath of the sanctions. Do you want us to legislate and provide for easy way out for non-compliant? If I can get just the responses to those, then I'll be happy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. The Honorable Madisha.
Thank you, Chair and members. Just two short points. Number one, permit me to put it to you that you are not prepared to increase. Is that the case? And secondly, I refer you to the points that or paragraphs that you have sent to us. I mean, if I were to refer you to 2.2 of clause number 5, the paper that you sent, and just to read, you say there, it is submitted that the contents of the clauses might be open to different interpretations and or ambiguous. The reason for this submission is the fact that sectoral determination must be in terms of the BCEA, etc., etc. I'm sure you have that. So it therefore says, in my own opinion, you are not even prepared to look into that. You are not following the BCEA, I mean, in line with what you have written here. And you are saying that, albeit this whole thing may be explained to the workers, to the unions, the employers, etc., they will not understand. I think that is a point that you are putting here. Okay. It's further strengthened by the 2.3 of the exemptions. You still go on there, on the second line, where you say a regulation is needed to, what does this say? To specify the time frame for applications and feedback and the presumption and exemptions, yes, have been granted if no communication has been received. In actual fact, you basically are saying you are not prepared to have this whole thing implemented. That's what I'm getting here. That yes, this whole thing may be explained to the workers, to the unions, to the people of South Africa, but they are not going to understand. Therefore, as a sequel to that, we are not prepared to implement. That's what you're saying here. So unless you give me the antithesis, I will remain with that particular point. Is this what you're saying?
Thank you, Honorable Madisha. Honorable Teko.
Thanks, Chair. On your presentation, you said something like losing jobs. There's a signed code of practice by employers. I wanted to check if you were not one of those who signed that upon introduction of the national minimum wage, no employees should lose their job. Have you signed or you haven't signed? The part that you are proposing here, you are saying you are proposing 3 years facing extension. I think you're extending 1 year on the proposed, on the bill. I want to check, on the current situation, there are those who are not complying, even on the sectoral department. How much time do you need for you to be ready once the implementation of national minimum wage takes place? So those are two questions that I need.
Thank you, Honorable Teko. We give over to you to respond. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Okay. Just let me start from the top. It is true the sectoral determinations are destined to disappear. We are very, very concerned about that because the sectoral determinations go much wider than what the Basic Conditions of Employment Act provides. So we believe it works in agriculture, and if it's implemented correctly, there's absolutely no reason for the sectoral determination to disappear. It takes into consideration the peculiarities of the agricultural sector, and we definitely support a position where we take those peculiarities from sector to sector into consideration. We don't have a blanket approach to all sectors. So, for instance, to say that workers have a baseline wage, that's absolutely true. We have our minimum wage. Just to clarify that as well, we are not opposed to a minimum wage. We have a minimum wage. It would be hypocritical of agriculture to oppose a minimum wage. We have had a minimum wage since, I believe, 2008. 2006, thank you very much. We do not oppose a minimum wage. We are saying that the amounts that we're talking about places a strain on agriculture, and we ask for that three-year period. That is, I'm going to stand by that. When it comes to the money that is being paid to employees, please also take into account that you have a situation where transport is paid on many farms for employees. There are more benefits than what is even provided for in the sectoral determination. So there really are some of our members, some of our farmers who go above and beyond and who are trying to alleviate this. But we'll get more to that as soon as I answer the rest of the questions. With regard to housing, you know, it is an incredibly contentious issue. It is not only an issue in agriculture, it is an issue throughout our country. Now, from AgriSA's side, we represent, as I said, 28,000 commercial farmers, not all the farmers. It's 28,000 of our commercial farmers. We are active participants in the AgriPakisa process as well. I'm more than willing to share more information with regard to that because I believe if we succeed in what we want to do with AgriPakisa, we're going to need all hands on deck, and that includes everybody, aside from political persuasion. It is a very important initiative that AgriSA is throwing all of our weight behind. Eroding the value of the 20 rand, I know absolutely that it's been mentioned at NEDLAC as well, in Tarsiems where I was present. I know that is the situation. The point I was trying to make, and I apologize if it was clumsily made, is the increases within agriculture has always been above inflation. And I believe if that trend continues, we would have naturally caught up to the national minimum wage. I feel that I also need to mention that we acknowledge that this is a minimum baseline. This is not, I don't believe that the intention of the legislation was ever that everybody must be paid at that level and nobody higher than that. This is just the bottom baseline. And it's also not to say that everybody in agriculture is going to earn the bottom baseline forever, because the truth is that would perpetuate the situation that we find ourselves in. So there is acknowledgement of that from AgriSA's side, and I just wanted to make that point as well. When it comes to economic development and social justice, I want to answer this with the last question that I received with regard to looking at job losses. First things first, we are signatories of the agreement in NEDLAC through our membership of BUSA. So because BUSA signed, AgriSA signed, we are part of that agreement. We know what the Act says, and it is very, very clear. That particular clause is backdated to 2017, that you're not supposed to touch anybody's conditions of service or end jobs or whatever the case may be in anticipation of the national minimum wage. The Act is clear, and we accept that. What we are saying is, if we are finding ourselves in a situation where a farming operation that was already on the brink because of what's happening currently with a drought or whatever the case may be, the rand strengthening, all of that has influence on our sector. If you find a farming operation that's already on the brink and the input cost rise by, it was going to be 17%, their wage bill would have increased by 17% if the minimum wage kicked in on the 1st of May of this year. And that farming operation closes down because it cannot continue anymore. The business is bankrupt. Then we are contributing to inequality. We are not doing our people justice. We are not doing unemployed people justice because we are adding to their numbers. Now, as far as mechanization and computerization, it's a highly contentious issue because if you look in terms of the fourth industrial revolution, as you pointed out correctly, the move in the world towards technological advances and away from a situation, I read articles to say that your menial jobs will disappear. That has serious, serious consequences for our country, especially if you look at education levels. It's a very, very bad situation that we find ourselves in. But the reality is, if your labor costs are going to get to a point where you have to make that sum for yourself, then there are people in our community, in our sector, who are going to have to make very difficult choices. And I also need to emphasize, that is not a choice that any one of AgriSA's members want to make. Definitely not. Now, as far as exemptions go, I think there was confusion, and I think it was with regard to the wording. The exemption processes in the past had situations where farmers would apply for exemptions, and then they never heard about that document again. They never got an answer whether the exemption was granted or not. It was an administrative problem. So what we sought to point out is we want a smoother administrative process for this. One of our members wants to know, is this granted? Is it not granted? Very, very simple. And what I wanted to point out is I made these submissions through a process that started in December of last year already. In the meantime, we have been engaging with the department. And the idea behind that engagement with the department is that we make sure that we have a streamlined administrative process when it comes to exemptions. We are committed to keep participating in that process to ensure. I can't really answer whether the feeling with regard to whether it should be part of legislation, aside from saying that I don't feel that it is healthy for any person to have so much power that they can solely decide on whether something is granted or not. So maybe I must just couch it in those terms and leave it there. Claims for failure to pay. Things have changed since the submission. We've actually signed a memorandum of agreement with the CCMA as well. So we are speaking to the CCMA. If you have disputes, and that's just speaking as a labor person, if you have disputes, you want them sorted out on the lowest possible level, and the CCMA is the lowest possible level, so that all the parties know that they have certainty and they can carry on. As for speaking for the unemployed, maybe in my next life, but unfortunately now, it would be disingenuous of me to speak on behalf of unemployed people. I was sent here to speak on behalf of a specific sector, and it is a sector that wants to help erode the numbers of the unemployed. Now, with regard to sawmilling, what I said about sawmilling is I didn't want to take up so much of your time because I know that Forestry South Africa was here and sawmilling is part of them, and they actually made a very extensive submission. So we appreciate it. We absolutely acknowledge that it is a sector that's in going to be in trouble if we start mechanizing. Farmworker housing, I've spoken about Pakisa. Please, I want to extend the invitation. The Secretariat has my contact details. We are serious about Pakisa. We are serious about farmworker housing, and we are serious about talking about these problems. So please feel free to engage me on that as well. Now, with regard to job losses after the Doer ends, I'm going to confirm the number and send it through to the Secretariat, but around about 30% of jobs were lost. And when we talk about job losses in agriculture, we have to factor in the fact that there are seasonal laborers, where a farmer in the past would have used a lot of seasonal laborers, they are now using fewer. And that also counts as a job loss at the end of the day. So there were definitely job losses. We are not trying to be alarmist at all. We don't want to be part of the problem. We do not want to add to unemployment at all. With regard to transformation, we absolutely are committed to making a meaningful contribution. I will put my head on a block. We have a conference actually next week, and I would like to send you the documentation that we've prepared. We did a survey under our members with regard to transformation. We're looking specifically, one of the aspects that we're looking at is worker involvement and basically looking at the Agri-BEE codes. All of the different factors that need to be taken into account, which include enterprise development, which include ownership. We are looking at that, and we are committed to building on what we have done in the past year as well. But the survey actually indicated some very interesting things that are happening, an interesting project that we would love to share. So that would be on the 23rd and the 24th of April that that will be shared. I acknowledge the minimum wage is different from the living wage. We know that. With regard to collective bargaining, we are again in a situation where it would be disingenuous for me to speak on behalf of that process. We are not an employer's organization. We're a policy influence organization. So I'm not a registered employer's organization. I do not sit on a bargaining council, especially not within agriculture. We have the last surveys that we have, and I think my comrades would probably have more updated statistics than I do, less than 10% unionization rate within agriculture. Five percent unionization rate within agriculture. So to talk about collective bargaining processes, the agricultural sector we sit with currently, we do not have those structures. So I cannot answer that question, unfortunately. When it comes to the numbers, the 12,500 versus the 5,300 versus the 3,500, the only thing that I can say about that is I do believe that, and it's a view that AgriSA carries as well, we need to, in addition to complying and paying our minimum wages as we are supposed to be doing, we need to look at entrepreneurial development as well. Because we are in a situation where, due to various factors, I honestly don't believe that anybody will ever become rich being a farm worker. I really don't. If there was a way, yes, but the reality is we need to focus on developing our enterprises and bringing workers into those enterprises and encouraging entrepreneurship of workers within the sector. Honourable members, all we want to do is feed you and clothe you. And if we can have more people feeding you and clothing you, our sector would be the better for it. Now, to say that we are not prepared to increase, we have already implemented our sectoral increases. I'm not saying that we are, as a sector, are not ready. I'm saying, please just give us the 3 years instead of the 2 years phasing in period. We do believe it will make an enormous difference at the end of the day. I'm sorry if it didn't come across as that clearly, Honourable Madisha, but honestly, to say that we are not prepared to increase is not what I was trying to convey here today. And to say when it comes to exemptions, we're not prepared to implement, also not what I was conveying today. What I was trying to say is, as far as administrative processes go, let's keep it clear, let's keep it concise, let's keep it to a situation where we can communicate easily to our members and they know exactly what to comply with. Now, I answered the job losses, and I think I answered the 3 years as well. But please, if there are any further questions, you know where to find me, and we will communicate in writing. It's absolutely no problem.
Thank you very much, Mr. Valiers, for that one. And to the honourable members, please take note that we have Busa still on our program, but unfortunately we need to break for half an hour to 40 minutes at the moment, just to give the honourable members an opportunity to have a comfort break and have a snack in the meantime. There's been a hand, Honourable Madisha.
You see, I'm extremely worried. What the an honourable lady there is saying is that albeit government can go on and come up with this thing, they are not going to implement. They will wait for 3 years, etc. Can you clarify that? Please, let that be clarified. Because that is what she has said. And my ears work properly. She has said that.
Thank you, Honourable Madisha. Honourable Moteka, we will get the questions now, and we will afford them the opportunity to reply via written responses, so that we can have it on black and white.
Let them just say yes or no. Please.
Okay.
Thanks, Jefferson. I think we must put this on record. They said their membership is 25,000, 28,000 employers, yes. And then these 28,000 employers, you must note it down that they employed people who cannot afford life. And now, and that is crisis. So we put it to you as an employer or a representative of the employers. What is your solution to this crisis? Because now, here comes the government. They are very lenient to you. They say 18 rand, of which to us is nothing. 18 rand. And then you're still crying with tears to say, I can't afford 18 rand. What is your solution to this crisis? Because this position of you can only feed and clothe people, I don't think the farm workers will appreciate it. They are only there to eat and clothe, really. Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Mutika. Can you just quickly respond in 1 minute?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We never said we're not going to implement. We never said we are not going to implement. We are not at the implementation stage at the moment. We are talking about the contents of the bills. And we are saying right now, as we stand here, our minimum wage is 16.25 rand, and our farmers have implemented 16.25 rand. If, by some miracle, say we manage to implement the 18 rand by the 1st of May of this year, the 18 rand, we would have been in a situation where we would have had small and medium farmers going under, and there would have been job losses. That's all that we're saying. If the implementation is brought in, we are concerned about consequences for some of our members, not all of our members. So we're not saying we're not going to implement. We have a zero tolerance policy when it comes to compliance. We really, really do have a zero tolerance policy, and I can say that very freely. When it comes to Agri-SA members, they need to comply with the law. If this law came in tomorrow to say that from tomorrow you need to pay 18 rand, our farmers are going to have to pay 18 rand. We're not at that stage yet. We're still at the stage where I can come to you and say, if you decide to make it tomorrow, and it's going to be tomorrow, there are going to be consequences for some of my members. That's the only point we wanted to make. But to say that regardless we're not going to comply with the law is absolutely incorrect. We will comply with the law. Now, with regard to the second, with regard to the 28,000 members saying employing people who cannot afford life, I just wanted to clarify what I meant by the feed and clothe. That's what we do in agriculture. Every farmer, every farm worker, that's what we do on a daily basis. We grow the things that feed and clothe South Africa, and that's the job we want to do. We're the only sector who had any growth in the previous quarter. So that was the only. But I didn't try to imply that all we want for farm workers is that they'd be able to feed and clothe themselves and not at all. I'm saying that's the job we are here to do, and that's the job we want to do. And for that, we need conducive conditions, just like any other business does. My solution to the crisis lies beyond a minimum wage. A minimum wage is never supposed to be the only thing that we aspire to. We are supposed to be aspiring to a lot more than 3,500. And we believe as Agri-SA that we are at the point where we can start developing plans where you develop people, including the workers of your farms, develop their entrepreneurial skills and start getting them bought into the economy. That was the point that I was trying to make. A minimum wage can never be the only thing that we talk about. It can never be the only thing that we aspire to.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mashile.
I did request an advice, which probably I may not have heard because I'm impaired a little bit. When I raised the figures of 12,005, 5,004, 3,500 by the different participants, then I asked from yourself, if you were to make a proposal, or maybe let me make it much more easy, if you were to advise on a figure that we must adopt, what would be your proposal?
Thank you.
Thanks.
I cannot advise on an amount. I'm very, very sorry, but from our side, my mandate only stretches so far, and I cannot advise on that.
Thank you very much. That's the wrap for now. We're going to break for lunch and we'll be back at 13:40. Thank you, members.